Casey has just seen the modern version of Skype for the first time, like the one that the rest of us have been seeing for like 6 months or something.
It is hilariously bad, just truly hilariously bad. The entire window is one humongous pane of blue that shows Marco's floating head until I mouse over it. And then I get a whole bunch of what the cool designer kids called fabs. Are you familiar with this trend, Marco?
No, not like silicon manufacturing production facilities, but like something else.
No, floating action buttons, Marco. It's the new cool thing.
Oh, God. Is that so when I hover and get all these round things, that's what these are? These have a name, not just badly implemented buttons.
And guess where I heard it first starting? Google.
Of course.
Remember, kids, material design is where it's at. Anyway.
Wait, so why are heads in fabs that aren't buttons?
I don't know. That
look identical to the buttons, except they have our heads in them.
Oh, this is truly heinous.
And why is John's head floating in the middle of the screen while your head is up on the upper right next to mine?
Well, see, you're my floaty guy title, and John is just relegated to the corner.
And also, didn't the previous version indicate to you who was talking?
Yes, that's correct.
So if you were on like some big conference call with a bunch of people you didn't know, you could tell who's talking, which is really nice.
On the plus side, I can show you a red heart, which I'm doing right now.
Oh, yes. There's a red heart on top of your fab.
Yes, indeed.
Can I put a middle finger on top of mine?
It's a thumbs up.
I can only do a thumbs up.
Why? You know, Jelly just sent me a text message, which makes a good point. Why aren't we trying like group FaceTime or something?
Inertia. This is proven. We know this works. It's the kind of thing that like, it's like, why don't you try, you know, new toilets in your house? It's like, it just, you know, this is serving a function for us that we need to just work. And we're not that interested in exploring a bunch of other things. Like, we just need this to work. Well, welcome to the same hell that the rest of us have been in for some time. I'm glad you were able to get to avoid it for this long. At least be thankful for that.
Yeah. The only reason I upgraded, or yeah, I don't know if this is really an upgrade, side graded, downgraded,
updated at least.
Updated is probably a better word. Thank you. The only reason I did is because the old Skype that actually made some amount of sense was pegging my CPU on my 5K iMac anytime it was open. And so I figured, okay, I might as well just bite this bullet. And wow, do I regret it.
Must have been your third party RAM.
Oh, here we go again. Welcome to the 300th episode, everyone. We are recording our 300th episode, and we are going to skip follow-up unbeknownst to John for a few minutes and mention that this is the 300th episode. How have you two been able to stick with me for this long, and more importantly, how have we not killed each other?
Yeah, that's kind of impressive. By the way, I should just claim right up front, I have a cold and my voice is going. So I sound worse already, and I might sound worse as the 300th episode spectacular goes on. We will find out. Anyway, so that aside, I think part of the reason why this has worked so well for so long for us is, you know, first of all, it's easy. We all three of us have no trouble talking tech. There has never been a week out of 300 weeks that we have not had enough to talk about, or that we have had trouble filling the time. So that's part of it. Part of it is that all of the practical stuff, the technical stuff, the scheduling stuff, all pretty much works out. You know, the three of us are all within the same time zone. We all have really good, solid internet connections. We never seriously, no, like you laugh, but like that when you're doing a podcast with somebody for a long time, that kind of stuff matters, right? Like,
we
never have like severe technical problems. Even John's Mac Pro has not lost more than one recording. So like, you know, so all the technical stuff is good, but you know, ultimately, you know, we're friends and we talk well together, and I think we have good chemistry. Like, I don't think it's boasting for us to say this. And so I think, you know, we like BSing with each other, and you like listening. That's all that really matters. You know, like everything else is secondary.
Yeah, I completely agree. And as the chief mush of the three of us, the chief emotional one of the three of us, self-anointed, I should add, I would just like to say that it is our tremendous pleasure, the three of us, to be able to do this at all, much less be compensated for it, much less be compensated reasonably well for it. So it is because of all the listeners who listen to us, who spread the word about the show, who buy our T-shirts and other merchandise, who do iTunes reviews, which we haven't talked about in like 200 episodes, but that still, I guess, maybe counts. but anyway, it is because of all of you that we are able to do this and enjoy doing this. And you know, there wouldn't be Ask ATP without you. There really wouldn't be ATP without you. So if you are listening to the words coming out of my mouth right now, then thank you, because it is because of all of you that we are able to do this.
Well, there would be ATP without them. It would just be a once a year show of the three of us BSing in the WWDC keynote line with each other.
Which is arguably how this all started.
That would be a long episode. Yeah, that was a lot of reminiscing. I put the item in the list here for the episode 300. We normally don't do anything for occasions, and I plan on not doing anything for this occasion. But I figured this was a good time for me to reflect on what I always reflect on when we have anniversaries. But this time I actually looked up some information about it. And that is the fact that we have been surprisingly very, very consistent. So our first episode was released on February 7th, 2013. That was 5 years, 9 months, and approximately 8 days after you're probably listening to this. 2,107 days ago. And I looked up our release schedule, and we released that first episode, which, if you don't know the origin of the show, like, it's in the song, but kind of. But it was an accidental show. We were doing Neutral as Car podcast, and we talked about tech like after the episode of Neutral was over, and those sort of neutral after shows about tech became the first episodes of Accidental Tech Podcast. So the first episode was like 36 minutes or something ridiculous like that long, because it was just an after show for another podcast. So we released that, and then there was a 2 week gap, and then we released episode 2. And that 2 week gap was like, I don't know, we were just figuring out if this is a thing we're going to do, or like, I don't even remember. Do any of you remember why there was a 2 week gap?
Well, the first episode was like on SoundCloud. Like, we didn't even have a website or anything set up because we didn't think it would be a thing. We're just like, hey, we kept the recording going after Neutral and talked about tech in a way that maybe our audience would want to hear. Let's just put it up somewhere and see what people think.
Well, slow down, though, because if my recollection serves me, and I have a terrible memory, that wasn't we that decided that. That was 100% Marco that decided to just throw this up on SoundCloud. And you probably ran it by us. Like, it's not that you did it in a nefarious way. But either way, it was because of your insight that you put that up on SoundCloud. You're absolutely right about that. And I thought it was like 3 or 4 episodes before we really realized, oh, this is what we should have been doing this whole time. And this car stuff, while entertaining to the three of us, is really not our bread and butter.
Yeah, like, I'm pretty sure it only took until the second episode before we had outdone Neutral's traffic. Like, it was real quick.
Yeah, so anyway, the release schedule, according to our RSS feed, which may or may not reflect the actual schedule of the way things dribbled out, we had that 2 week gap. But after that 2 week gap between episode, quote unquote, episode 1, which again was like very abbreviated in episode 2, after that, from episode 2 through episode 300, we have done one episode a week for 5 years, 9 months, and 8 days.
That is ridiculous.
And it doesn't mean that we do them all exactly on a Wednesday, because we have vacations and we arrange things. So the bottom line is there are, you know, 52 weeks in a year, and every year we're putting out 52 episodes for 5 years. The only exception being that little gap when the thing was getting started with the weird episodes at the beginning, which are totally weird. Like, the people who go back and listen to episode 1, A, I salute you, and B, boy, it must be really weird to hear this first episode. So that's one of the things I'm the most proud of, that for lack of a better term, I mean, even though Marco said this is easy, our work ethic. Like, yes, it is easy, but we all have lives and you know, other things going on. And try doing anything every single week for 5 years. And having any other kind of obligations, let alone, you know, families and kids and, in my case, another job to go to and all the other stuff. So that's it. That's all I wanted to mention, to give her, you know, we're already up our own butts about this whole thing, to give ourselves a pat on the back about the fact that we've done a thing every single week for 5 years.
Yeah, I'm very proud of that.
And we cheat a little bit by, like, you know, like, if there's a holiday or somebody's traveling, we will like double record 1 week and like maybe, you know, release it like a little bit later. But
yeah, but we're just trying to provide a consistent product. You know, 52 times a year, you'll get an ATP episode.
So while we're in the mushy butts segment, I also just wanted to point out that this about a year ago or something like that, this surpassed my previous longest job, as this is now my longest job I ever had.
Aww.
And this for about 5¾ years. Previously, Overcast is the runner up because I started Overcast only a few months after we started this show. It wasn't launched yet, but I started working on it like roughly that June. So Overcast started, you know, roughly, you know, June 2013. So that's about 5½ years. And then Instapaper was next longest. Tumblr was actually the least long until I go all the way back to my job in Pittsburgh. That was only 2 years, but you know, Tumblr was a little over 4. Instapaper was 4.5, Overcast 5.5, and ATP about 5.75. So this is my longest job I've ever had, and it's going to stay that way for a long time, probably because Overcast started after it did. So yeah, it's pretty cool.
You know, it just occurred to me just this moment, that's true for me too, because my longest stint was when I first moved to Richmond. I worked for a company for 4 and change years or something like that. So I knew that this was the longest for you, and that's because, haha, Marco always changes his job, haha. But no, actually, for me as well, it's the same story. It just occurred to me now. I never even realized that. Wow, that's wild.
Got a while to go to catch up with me. I think I'm about double that in my current job.
Oh, wow. That is a long time.
Mm-hmm. It's a lot of pearl.
It's a lot of pearl. All right. So I, you know, when we were realizing, when we had come to the realization that we were approaching episode 300, we all kind of looked at each other, well, as much as you can inside a Slack chat room, but we all looked at each other and said, kind of, are we going to do anything? And in typical ATP fashion, the answer was basically no. But I was trying to rack my brain for something.
I did something. I looked up things.
That's true.
That's something.
I computed all of these job durations.
Well, and my contribution to not recognizing this 300th episode and not making it that spectacular is I wanted to ask you two, what is your favorite episode or perhaps moment that you can think of in the run? Because, and this came from me thinking, not that I necessarily wanted to do a clip show, but it would be fun to have gotten like a handful of clips from years past and handed them to Marco to staple in. We are not doing that because we're not, but
it actually crossed my mind. Like, wouldn't it be funny to make like a clip show as a joke, really? And then I realized like that would actually be way more work for me.
Exactly.
Like, you know, like when like a TV show makes a clip show, it's great because like they don't have to like have all the actors come in and shoot new scenes. It's way less work for them because they can just have a couple interns going through clips and pulling things together. Whereas like when you are the editor of the podcast, a clip show is actually way more work for you than it is to just record a new episode.
Exactly right. So we're not going to do a clip show, but I ask, and I will start with Marco, what is your favorite episode or perhaps moment from the show that, at least sitting here today, maybe you changed your mind, but sitting here now, what was your favorite episode?
Oh, easy. Windows of Syracuse County.
Why do you say that?
It was, I think it was, it, not only was it incredibly entertaining, but it revealed, it was like the best kind of thing. It's like, I don't even remember what the rest of the episode was about. I don't care. It's just the after show. Like it was revealing.
Was that the after show? I thought that was a topic.
No, I think it was the after show.
Yes. So we have no idea what happened in the show. There's so many episodes to remember. I'm sure we'll get corrections.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
But it was just like, you know, as a listener of shows, you know, like the kind we listen to and hopefully the kind we make, I care much more about the people than the topics. And it's my favorite moments of podcasts are when the people have a really funny moment with themselves, where like their chemistry just works really well together and they like uncover something crazy about another host or one another and they all laugh about it. Like that's not an uncommon pattern. Like, you know, that happens a lot on the kind of shows that we make, you know, the kind of like unscripted shows about friends, you know, with friends talking. And I think that was one of our moments, you know, when we discovered the way John runs his windowing on his computer and quite the extent of which that happens. I think that was a moment for our show. It was my favorite as the host of the show. I've heard a lot from listeners that it was their favorite as well. So that to me is probably my favorite moment.
John?
That's tricky. Like as a listener, I bet listeners of the show have different favorite episodes than we as hosts do. Trying to think of favorite episode/moments. One of my favorite moments, which probably does not rate for highly in listeners' minds, is our first live show when the audience sang the song. I thought that was
pretty cool.
Like, and a lot of people don't like our live shows, and they're definitely different than our regular shows. And if you're not at the live show, I can kind of see where you're coming from. It's like, well, can I just have a regular episode? And now there's all this weird audience noise, and the shows are shorter, and like, blah, blah, blah. But if, and honestly, I don't know how it's like to be there, but I can tell you to be the person doing the live show and to have the audience sing your theme song, that's really cool. So for me personally, that was a really cool moment. And my honorable mention in top four fashion is, this is kind of in typical Marco fashion, is not actually an episode, but a category of episodes. it's, and again, this is just strictly as a host. And, you know, so like occasionally I'll have, you know, just, I guess there's a typical day at work or whatever, work and family stuff, right? And at the end of my long day, I have an episode of ATP. And I know sometimes it can seem like, oh, you've had a full day and now you have to sit down and record. You have to keep working. There's more stuff that you have to do, right? And then you just, right after that, you're going to go to bed. It can feel like a very full day. But my favorite kinds of episodes are the ones where I had a crappy day or like just a tiring day. And then we do an ATP. And by the end of the ATP, like I feel better. Like, you know, it's not usually not that impressive of an episode, but we just had a good time. We talked about fun things. Like, it cheers me up at the end of the day. Like, those are my favorite kinds of episodes for me as a host, is when I just had just a grind of a normal day. And, maybe I'm not even looking forward to doing it. I'm like, oh, I got to do a podcast for it. But by the end of the episode, I go to bed happy. Those are my favorite kinds of episodes. The episode where like the additional quote unquote work I have to do that day actually makes the whole rest of the day better. And I have a surprising amount of those. Sometimes it makes it hard to go to sleep at the end of it, because I'm like happy and jazzed about whatever it is we talked about it again. I don't know if those are the episodes that end up being favorites of the people listening, but as the person who does the episodes, I really like that.
All right, so to answer my own question, I have two honorable mentions because I also listen to Top 4. Honorable mention number one was the 2 minutes that just happened, because now I'm all misty-eyed, and that's adorable, and I love you, John. But my other honorable mention actually is exactly what, John said, that when the audience sang to us, was it 2017? It was not this year.
That was the WWDC 2017 show.
Okay. That was... like, on the one side, I think all three of us kind of expected it to happen, but actually witnessing it happening was bananas, was utterly bananas, and extremely, extremely cool. And to be in front of 1,000 people that are genuinely jazzed to see you and your two really, really good friends is a really messed up feeling in the best possible way that I don't know how to describe. And that is a true honorable mention. But if I had to choose only one moment, I can tell you off the top of my head, it is the end of episode 96, which is called The Windows of Syracuse County, because yep. As Marco said, my recollection anyway, and this was, you know, a couple of years ago now, but my recollection is that I was literally crying. I was laughing so hard listening to John and ribbing John and just all, everything about it. And Marco and I going back and forth in various states of utter disbelief, utter hilarity, and like almost anger that John was defending himself with this. And you have to understand that, what was, John, the episode of Hypercritical that involved Syracuse County? Do you remember off the top of your head?
Bridges of?
Okay, there you go. Right. Okay, because it was Madison County, and knockoff on Madison County. Is that right? Mm-hmm. And so because of that episode, Bridges of Syracuse County, for the longest time, and this actually still kind of happens sometimes, and that was episode 15. Holy smokes. I didn't realize it was that early in Hypercritical's run. So anyway, so episode 15 of Hypercritical was Bridges of Syracuse County. And so every time we had somebody in the chat room, you know, suggesting titles for all of these ATPs, for 95 episodes, they would always come up with, you know, something of Syracuse County titles, to the point that I coded the show bot to give a snarky reply about, oh, you can do better than that, anytime somebody suggested that. And at the end of episode 96, it was clear, at least to Marco and I, if I remember correctly, that we had no choice but to use a Syracuse County title. And our agreement, if I recall correctly, Marco, was that this is the one and only time that will ever happen, and it will never happen again for the rest of the run. And I stand by that decision, because, oh my word, that episode is great. And if you haven't heard it, you need to go listen to it.
Yeah, I firmly stand by that. Like, we made the right call that if we're going to ever do this once, this is the time to do it. And sure enough, you know, almost 4 years later, that was still the right call. I would also say now that I knew that it's okay to like recommend, you know, topics instead of just, you know, episodes, my favorite type of diversion is the food diversion.
Yes, I have concluded that as well.
This is a recent trend. I don't know if we're all hungry because we're on diets now, or just like, keeps coming up on this show.
Well, it's great because all three of us feel very strongly about food and cooking and how we make things and what is good. At the same time, though, our taste in those things and our opinions of those things have fairly little overlap. And so it's a very, very good area for us to go into. And the audience seems to enjoy it quite a bit as well. So it isn't just us who like it.
They're all on diets, too. I had someone, a young person, I had a young person at work ask me today what Sicilian pizza was, if you want to know what kind of day I had. I pulled up a picture on the internet of my favorite pizza in the entire world, which happens to be Sicilian. I said, it's this.
So, okay, I'm gonna bite. Tell me why Sicilian is not just deep dish, man.
Because it's not. It's nothing like deep dish. What are you talking about?
Well, first of all, it's square.
No, it's not. That's not the major difference. The major difference is it's not a giant, weird cornmeal bucket filled with sauce and cheese. Like, it's, I don't know what you're talking about. Have you had deep dish pizza and have you had Sicilian? They're not the same thing.
No, they're not at all the same.
I don't think I've had deep dish, at least not like proper Chicago deep dish. I have had Sicilian a lot, though, and I like it. But it is a lot of bread. It's, you know, there's so much more dough in it that like you fill up on so much bread so fast.
Finding good Sicilian is really difficult because you can screw it up very badly. But my favorite pizza in the world happens to be Sicilian, not because from two particular places on Long Island. But I don't think I've had Sicilian that I like almost any place else.
That's odd to me that a true to form proud New Yorker would enjoy a pizza that does not require it to be folded.
No, you can't fold it.
I know, that's my point. But to me, you would know a New Yorker because they immediately fold their pizza, whether or not they really need to. But this, to your point, you are not folding a Sicilian pizza. It is not happening.
See, I actually don't fold my pizza. And maybe that's because I was born in Ohio. I know. But but even once I learned the way of the fold, I don't do it because when you fold it, the little crease in the back becomes a dripping spout of grease.
Yeah, that's where the orange grease comes out.
Right, and I don't like getting my hands greasy or anything like that. So like, there's a high risk of hand greasiness if you fold it. It's much lower if you don't.
As Marilyn would say, you're a fancy duchess.
Oh my word! All right. Well, anyway, we can stop navel gazing.
Yeah, we just did it again. Anyway.
Yeah. But no, thank you to the listeners one more time for indulging us not only just over these last few minutes, but somebody should add up exactly how much time all these 300 episodes have added up to be, because, oh my word, we've talked to each other for a lot, and I am very proud of the work we've done. I'm very proud of our work ethic because, you know, like John was saying, it takes some pretty significant scheduling hurdles and gymnastics in order to get this stuff done, especially over summertime, where it has come to my conclusion that the three of us are extremely talented at picking not overlapping times to go on vacation. Because especially, I think this past summer, it was basically three straight weeks that one of us was going to be gone and in a position where recording would be very uncool. So it isn't that hard in the grand scheme of things, but it's hard. And I'm proud of us, and I'm proud of our listeners for sticking with us. And I appreciate all of our listeners for sticking with us. And thank you.
We are sponsored this week by Change the Terms. Visit changetheterms.org to learn more. Following the deadly events of the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, Virginia on August 12, 2017, the tech industry finally started to take real steps to address the spread of hate speech online and the ways their platforms are used to organize, fund, and recruit for white supremacists and other hateful movements. But there's a group of organizations looking for the tech industry to do more to protect people of color, women, LGBTQ people, religious minorities, and other marginalized communities. For the past year, Change the Terms, which is made up of civil rights, anti-hate, and open internet organizations, has been working on a set of corporate policies to help tech companies stop hate and extremism online. The coalition has shared these policies with tech giants like Facebook, Google, and Twitter. The corporate policies that Change the Terms developed are intended to help internet companies reduce hateful activities that are taking place on their platforms. By implementing and following these policies, tech companies can help stop the spread of hateful activities via social media, web hosting, and online financial transactions. Change the Terms is asking internet users to call on tech giants like Facebook, Google, and Twitter to lead the industry in stopping online hate. To learn more and to help out, visit changetheterms.org. Once again, visit changetheterms.org to learn more. Thank you so much to Change the Terms for sponsoring our show.
We should probably do some follow-up. And let's start with Apple, making a MacBook Air with Retina display battery replacements easier so that it no longer requires replacing the top case. How excellent is that? Do you want to tell us about this, John?
You look at the iFixit teardown of the new MacBook Air. It's got some interesting things in there. Of course, iFixit's whole position is they want everything to be repairable, and Apple's position for the past several years is they don't care about that, so they would make these devices, obviously the phones and the other iOS devices, but even the Macs, sealed up with no room to spare for anything and lots of components glued inside it, or lots of components combined together into a single thing. We talked a lot about replacing the any part of the keyboard on one of the 2016 and 2017 and probably also 2018 MacBook Pros. That you had to replace the entire top case. You couldn't just replace the keyboard part of it because everything was all glued together. So the new 2018 MacBook Air has some interesting developments, sort of reverting to a simpler time of Apple laptop design, where the batteries are, so there's lots of things that are still glued in there, like the speakers and the batteries, but they're on these little, I don't know how to describe it, but you guys know those 3M strips where you can, like, put a hook on the wall, but they know that you're going to have to take it off because, like,
command strips.
You rent the apartment. Mm-hmm. Yeah, whatever. And there's a little pull tab at the bottom of it, and you pull, like, there's adhesive on the back, and you stick it to the wall, but there's a little dangly bit of the adhesive that hangs down. You grab that little dangly bit and pull, and it stretches the adhesive out. And in the course of stretching it out, it lets it disengage from the wall, in theory, without damaging the wall. So a whole bunch of the components, including the batteries and the speakers, inside the MacBook Air have these little pull tabs on, which is way better than the thing being glued down there and having to, like, pry it up or melt the glue. Like, they're designed with the knowledge that, look, you might need to replace a battery on this. And actually, the MacBook Air has two batteries, one on each side of the laptop, that you can replace individually. Same thing with the speaker assemblies. They've done this for a while, but it was noted in the MacFixer thing as well, that the ports, like the things, the precious few ports that are even in this thing, are all on secondary circuit boards. So if someone jams something into one of your USB-C ports, or someone breaks off the headphone thing and the precious headphone jack that's on the side or whatever, you don't need to replace the entire motherboard, such as it is. You just need to replace this tiny, tiny little daughter card that's connected by a ribbon cable to everything else. So lots of Apple laptops have done that for a while. And just in general, the ability to get into the thing and take pieces out and replace them is better than it has been in the past. And this is especially impressive considering that the MacBook Air is not a roomy machine. It's not like, well, this is the big one where there's tons of room. No, it's very skinny and things are very tightly packed, but it is better designed for repairability than the other one. So I thought that was worth noting because it is a trend in the right direction. That also brings up a secondary topic. This is based on some conversations I think people have been having in Slack lately and elsewhere. Like, how the MacBook Air that we see now, is this a product that was started many years ago and it has finally come out? Or is this a product that was created in haste based on feedback from the beginning in 2015 line of laptops? Obviously, Apple's never going to tell us. But looking at the inside of the thing, I don't know. I'm thinking there are some things to suggest that this was not a hastily slapped together laptop. But there are also things to suggest that its design reflects feedback received from the 2015, 2016, and maybe even 2017 years of MacBook Pros. So I like the trend is in the right direction, and I'm not sure which would be more reassuring, if this was hastily assembled based on poor sales of the MacBook Escaped, or if this was a 3 or 4 year project that just happened to come out when it did. I like to believe that it was a longer running project and they merely incorporated feedback into it as it was being developed. But, you know, we'll find out in 50 years when people write their tell-all books, if they can still remember what the heck happened, because we can't even remember what happened 5 years ago on our show.
I'm one of the people who thinks that they probably started this about 2 years ago. You know, when it became clear that the reactions to the MacBook Pro line that launched 2 years ago were not as positive as they wanted them to be, because this does incorporate a lot of feedback from those. It is improved from those in a number of ways while still being one of those generation machines. I don't think back then Apple thought they had to replace the MacBook Air. I think they thought the new MacBook Pros would eventually come down in price and be able to get cheap models to replace it. And that kind of happened with this new one. Like, it's kind of that, but, you know, kind of not. And so, you know, I think I'm very happy to see these design updates. Like, it's not major in the sense that, like, it doesn't have things I wanted. It doesn't have a new keyboard. It doesn't have more ports or the return of a card reader or anything like that. So, you know, this is not a machine that is ideal for me. But I gotta say, like, people do seem to be liking it a lot. And liking it a lot more than they have liked, say, the MacBook Escape, which is very similar. You know, like, as I talked about before with this machine, like, on paper, like, if you weren't buying the MacBook Escape for some reason, I don't see why that reason still applies. And all of a sudden people want to, or it doesn't apply, and all of a sudden people want to buy this who didn't want to buy that, but they do. And over the weekend, I was in a store a couple times, and I got to pick one up and play with it for a little bit longer. And, you know, I got to say, it does feel a lot better. Like, I've been carrying around the 13-inch MacBook Pro for a while now, which is very similar. It's only a quarter pound heavier, and it's a little bit thicker at the front. You know, it doesn't have the wedge shape. But the Air feels better. Like, the difference in how good it feels is bigger than you would expect. Like, when you're carrying it, when you're holding it, when you're using it, it really is a nicer feeling computer than my 13-inch MacBook Pro. And there's a few reasons, a few areas. A lot of it just comes down to the size, like how easy it is to pick up off the table. You know, John's favorite argument. It's, you know, it's super great picking it off the table, you know, opening and closing one-handed. It feels, the wedge feels really nice. If you remember, I had a very obscure complaint with the 13-inch MacBook Pro, which I think applies to all the 2016 and forward MacBook Pro models, where, like, the ridge under the left and right front side of the case, which is which I believe is an intake vent, there's a ridge on both sides, and like, when you pick up the laptop, your fingers go into that ridge, and it's sharp, and it feels pretty unpleasant to actually hold the laptop, you know, by those edges. The MacBook Air doesn't have those ridges. It's a totally different, you know, design on the bottom. And so, like, I found it really nice and really pleasant to pick up and carry around and use the MacBook Air in ways that the 13-inch and 15-inch Touch Bar models don't feel that nice. So I can see why people like this thing, even though it's not completely rational or not completely based on specs, because the specs, I think, aren't a very good deal for the money. What a lot of reviewers are finally noting is that the screen is also a lot less bright. It's only 300 nits instead of 500 compared to the MacBook Pro. So, like, it's not a very bright screen. It is a nice screen, but it's not a bright screen. It's pretty slow. You know, it's roughly, you know, MacBook class. And reviewers are saying that you hear the fan spin up a lot when it's working hard, and because it's MacBook class, that's often. And so, like, there's reasons why it will remind you it's a low end machine, but it does seem really nice. And so I'm understanding now a little bit better why people who didn't like the Escape or 13-inch Pro like the Air, even though on paper it doesn't make sense.
We have ours here now as well. And, you know, I've been using it. And if I don't think about the price, it's nice. You know, having Touch ID with no Touch Bar is really nice.
Yeah.
It seems nice and quick. The wedge shape, you know, to your point about it feeling nice, I talked a lot about this over the past year or so, but, like, the wedge shape really is a perceptual thing that makes the thing feel different and better and familiar to people who like the MacBook Air. And I was replacing a 2011 MacBook Air with this 2018 one, so it all fits together well. I like the fact that it's smaller than the, like, you know, length and width wise than the 2011 that it's replacing, but that it has, you know, an equal screen, more or less, if you run it at non-native res, which is still a bit of a sore point. It looks like a machine that's well put together. I really wish it had more ports. I really wish it didn't have this keyboard. We already talked about this before, but in the grand scheme of things, it is a reasonable, what we hope is the last gasp of this particular laptop design, with some changes internally that I hope continue on into the future laptop designs. All that stuff about command strip pull tabs on all the stuff and being able to replace pieces individually, you know, and that's all good.
Yeah, especially, like, for the MacBook Air line, you know, like I mentioned, you know, when we were talking about this new model, like, the MacBook Air needs to be especially serviceable and especially rugged and durable, because it is used so often in places like schools where you really, like, where, you know, they're going to get beaten up. You know, a lot of kids use them, a lot of, you know, careless adults use them, like, or they use it in environments that are just difficult environments. And that's why I think the butterfly keyboard is still a huge problem on this machine. But other than that, that is now my only complaint about this machine. Everything else seems like they really addressed the needs of the MacBook Air market pretty well, at least as well as modern Apple could have. Also, by the way, I find the gold color really fascinating on this thing. Like every time, you know, between the website and the press hands-on area and seeing it in stores, in a couple different stores now, this color looks different every time I see it. It kind of floats between like gold and orange and a little bit salmony pink, and I have no idea what to call this color, but if I was at all into the you know, goldish hues of things, I would love this color. Unfortunately, I'm not, but it's a really fascinating case color.
So I have a really random question with regard to the MacBook Air. It is clear that since it has no touch bar, that is a concession, and I would guess it is almost certainly because of cost. But it does have Touch ID. So do you view this keyboard layout, so do you view the presence really of Touch ID as a concession that the touch bar is imperfect, or do you think it is strictly and only a financial problem?
Just cost.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think what will answer that question for us is like when there is a next generation of MacBook Pros, do we get this option? You know, or is this all that we get? Like, is a touch bar totally gone from them, or does it become optional, replaced with this as one of the other options, right? And we don't know yet. And honestly, I wouldn't bet on that happening. It does seem like Apple is really in on the touch bar, even though many of us are not. but I don't know. I think in this model, it's very likely to just be cost. And even if they could have put it in there and maintained pretty good margins otherwise, I think they probably didn't put it in for market segmentation reasons. Like the touch bar, whether or not it costs them extra money, it is used to justify higher prices on the higher end models. So if they put it on the lower end models, that removes a key difference from them, and that makes the pricing jump, you know, less justifiable to customers.
Yeah, that's a fair point. Also, some real-time follow-up on command strips. You will never guess, particularly Marco, what the URL for the command strips is, what host name it is. It is command.com.
Oh, man.
How does that make you feel from like 15, 20 years ago?
I thought I was going to say command.strip.
No.
No, it's a Windows reference, not a Mac OS reference.
Actually, it's a DOS reference.
A DOS, yeah, right.
Yeah. So how about them, Apples?
Unfortunately, autoexec.bat is not a valid TLD.
What about config.sys? Anyway, tell me, one of you who put this in the show notes, about Mac Pro going ARM in 2020.
This is actually related to our moments ago musing about the timelines associated with the MacBook Air, right? So this quandary that I brought up a couple shows ago about the new Mac Pro coming and Apple ever more strongly signaling that they're going to put ARM chips in Macs because the ARM chips are awesome and they would work really well in Macs. As the primary CPU, that is. The Mac Pro, like, okay, well, the Mac Pro is coming. They said it's coming. It's a 2019 product. Will this be the last great Intel-based Mac, or will it be the first, hopefully, great ARM-based Mac? You know, and this is me getting nervous about buying it because both cases have upsides and downsides. Obviously, if it was the last great Intel Mac, it's kind of weird to be buying the last of a generation, but then it's kind of good to get just one more Intel Mac. And if it's the first ARM one, it's like, well, was it going to run all my software? How's it, you know, all sorts of other issues related to being ARM. So both of them are exciting and scary for various reasons. But the ARM thing, a lot of people say, well, how can they be ready to have an ARM Mac? Yes, I know we've been waiting, you know, 2 years for the Mac Pro, but if they just decided 2 years ago that they're going to do a Mac Pro at all, that's not enough time to make a Mac Pro caliber ARM CPU and to make a new Mac and to ship it all. It's just not, right? And that makes sense, right? But in thinking about timelines, you have to remember the butterfly effect, alternate timeline where the Mac Pro never existed and the Apple never decided to make another one. In that timeline, which was our timeline for a long time, the iMac Pro was the only Pro Mac at the top end, the Pro desktop Mac. The decision was, 2 years ago, oh, actually, that's not enough. We have to make a proper Mac Pro with a separate display and all that other business, right? But before they made that decision, it is conceivable that they said, we're going to do the ARM transition, and, you know, in 2019-ish, 2020-ish, we want to release our first Macs with ARM processors in them, and, you know, maybe one of them will be at the high end. So their plan could have been, okay, in 2019 or 2020, that's when we'll release the iMac Pro with an ARM processor. And that ARM processor could have been in the planning and design stage 5 years ago, right? So I feel like the decision to make a Mac Pro can be entirely separate from the much more distant past decision that Apple made to bring a high-end ARM chip out suitable for its high-end desktop computers. And that you could, you decide to make a Mac Pro, it's not impossible that it could be ARM, provided that the previous plan was to bring out an ARM iMac Pro. And so that's got me thinking more seriously about the prospect of the new Mac Pro being ARM, whereas before I couldn't think about it seriously at all because there's just not enough time to make a Pro caliber ARM processor. But if I just think, well, it's just going to use the one they would have otherwise used in the iMac Pro, and that one they started planning 5 or 6 years ago. That at least is conceivable. Is it true? Do we have anything to support it? No, I'm just musing or whatever. But I thought I would bring that up just because it's something that I hadn't heard offered on this show or elsewhere, and it makes me start entertaining for real the idea of an ARM Mac Pro, even though I still think it's a distant second to the much more obvious choice of it just being, you know, a Xeon.
Is there a particular preference that you have? You know, if they called you in and said, John, it's up to you, ARM or Intel, what are we doing?
ARM would definitely be more exciting. And also, you have to believe that ARM would be faster at this point, right? Like that if they did have a Pro caliber, you know, 16 core ARM CPU. But I'm scared about compatibility. And I'm as weird as it would be to have like the last one of the last round of Intel Macs, I don't know. I'd probably be okay with it. I'm okay with either one. Like, they're both exciting for different reasons. I wouldn't be super disappointed. It's not like I wouldn't buy it if Intel Mac Pro comes out and then, like, 6 months later, the ARM MacBook Air comes out and it's amazing. I'm not going to mind about that. Like, I don't know. I don't feel like I have a strong preference. The ARM one is more technologically exciting, but the Intel one will probably be a more useful machine for longer. And I don't plan to keep my next computer for 10 years like I've kept this one. Like, it's never the plan. You know, 5 years, maybe 3 years, maybe 10 years. No, that is never the plan. Just things have gone awry.
One question I had about, like, I was thinking the other day, there was some interview. Oh, it was, I think it was the Ars Technica interview of Anand Lalshimpi and Phil Schiller talking about the A12X and, you know, how awesome it is. And I was wondering, like, you know, they mentioned, you know, one of the reasons why iOS is able to be so fast is that it has unified memory architecture between the CPU and the GPU. There's just one bank of RAM, and it's very fast, you know, one bank of very fast RAM that is fast enough to be video RAM that is also used as the main CPU RAM. And that way, you know, like in PCs and Macs, the GPUs have their own separate banks of video RAM, and you have to be shuffling data back and forth over these buses to get data from main memory or from the CPU, you know, to the GPU texture memory or, you know, video memory, and vice versa if you do computation back and forth and everything. And so that shuffling data back and forth between main memory and video memory is like a major performance bottleneck, and there's a lot of effort that needs to go into, like, you know, optimizing for that when you're designing stuff that uses the GPU on Macs and PCs. And with iOS, it's just way, way simpler because it's just one bank of RAM that's all super fast that the CPU and GPU can access. So I was wondering, in a situation where they go to ARM for Macs, would they go to a unified memory architecture also?
No, like the old term for that, I wouldn't consider it a unified memory
architecture. I guess shared memory?
Shared memory architecture is the pejorative term for it. It's like, oh, well, cheap computers can't afford to have dedicated VRAM, so they just share the RAM between. Like, that was, for many years, that was the slam against the low-end Macs. It's like, but you don't get dedicated VRAM.
Right, because integrated GPUs usually do that.
Right. They have to, because where else they don't have room for a bunch of VRAM. But
well, some of them have their own little RAM packages now, but
at the high end, like, you can buy GPUs with like, what, 12 gigabytes of RAM of some sort, just for the GPU, like separate from the system memory. And
but those are like Mac Pro level GPUs. Like what are gamer ones have now? Like 3 or 6?
Yeah, yeah. Well, a lot of it. But the other thing about the RAM that's dedicated, next to the GPU is that it is designed differently than just generic memory. Like the bus widths are insane, right? So it can be accessed in parallel by a huge number of things in the GPU. Now, it's still true that getting information to and from the CPU and main memory and stuff like is more of a pain. But once you're there, the GPU and its dedicated VRAM have a relationship that cannot be matched by the relationship that most CPUs have to their local RAM, because the VRAM on GPUs and the whole bus architecture around it is specifically designed for GPUs only, and it doesn't have to keep up with all the demands that regular memory has. It just has to be super wide and super high bandwidth, and I think the simplification for the iOS devices is it's much easier to optimize for energy efficiency and for just in general dealing with bugs and optimizations when you have a single, simple, known architecture and you don't have to deal with, well, sometimes it's over here and sometimes it's over there and sometimes we have to ship between. But part of the point of metal, there are many purposes to metal, but one of them is making more efficient use of the bandwidth between a CPU and a dedicated video card in terms of command sequences and how many times you have to communicate back and forth between the two areas. So I think on the high end, things are still going to necessarily be more complicated for a long time to come. On the lower end, obviously, I think, Apple has shown that you can do a quote unquote integrated GPU better than Intel has done it, or better than Intel seems to want to do it, because occasionally Apple has pushed Intel to put beefier integrated graphics, the whole Iris graphics architecture around its CPUs, because Apple wanted better integrated GPUs that can do more of the stuff that at the time macOS needed to do with GPUs. Apple can do better still, as it's shown with its iOS devices. So I think on all but the highest of high end, Apple can do a pretty good job of its quote unquote integrated GPU being sufficient, all certainly through the whole MacBook line and the MacBook Air, maybe even well into the MacBook Pro line, especially with the ability to use external GPUs. They could just say, look, the new Pro way to do it is we give you a pretty awesome integrated GPU on your ARM MacBook Pro. And if you need something even beefier, then do eGPU. I think that is a reasonable position and will have all the wins that you talked about in terms of simplification and, optimization and battery life, hopefully, and all that other stuff. So, like, the prospect of an ARM Mac, again, looking at the new iPad Pros, the prospect of an ARM Mac has never been more tantalizing and easy to see, because if you look what they've been able to do in a completely fanless 5.6 millimeter thin slab, it's like, what could they do with a full laptop with a huge battery and two fans in it? Like, the power would be unbelievable.
Well, see, that's why I think, because the ARM designs would most likely, first of all, they would most likely lack Thunderbolt, because Thunderbolt is an Intel technology, and I think Intel's now willing to license it, but
money can fix that problem, like I said before. I believe in the power of money and Intel's need for that money.
Well, sure. But, because they would lack Thunderbolt, probably, at least at first, and they would also probably lack a lot of, like, the, huge high bandwidth PCI Express lane arrangements. Like, I know internally, I think modern iOS devices do have PCI Express, but I don't know if they would have so many lanes of it that they could be like, they could offer like Mac Pro level just bandwidth and throughput to things. That's why I think it is much more likely that the first ARM Mac start at the low end, especially the 12-inch MacBook. It seems like an obvious.
Yeah, I mean that they could have been making them for years already. You just look at the chips that are yeah, in the iOS device. You could take those and just slap them into a MacBook, and it would be unbelievable. So that's what everyone's the obvious thing people expect. But I think the iPad Pro, the most recent one, showed me that they've got enough grunt now that they're already with the things that they've released now today are within striking distance if you just like double the number of cores and increase the clock speed and put a fan and a big cooler on it. They're already within striking distance. So I'm just suggesting things that make me put it into the realm of possibility, not that make me think that they're going to do it instead of a laptop, because a laptop is a much more obvious win.
What's also interesting to think about, to me anyway, is that I feel like we're starting to have these multi-headed laptops, you know, because the T2 chips, they're all ARM, like old A-whatever chips, aren't they? They're all old CPUs from like older Apple devices or very close to them, aren't they?
Well, not quite, but they're... I think the T2 is like roughly an A10 in performance. It's not like they didn't just literally take those chips unmodified, but I think architecturally, I think it is roughly A10 class.
Yeah, the CPU cores, that's why how they're classifying them. Yeah, it's not an A10 system on a chip, but if you look at the CPU core part of it, it looks like the same architecture as the cores that were used in the A10.
Yeah, so that has kind of come out of nowhere over the last couple of years, and it seems like the T chips are taking on more and more and more of a role within Apple laptops. So do they just kind of, you know, envelop them, like, you know, white blood cell style, like all of a sudden there's no Intel chip left, or the Intel chip is only for, you know, things that haven't been compiled for ARM, which I know it's not quite that simple, but just for the sake of discussion, you know, over time, does the T2 chip kind of just subsume and consume whatever the needs of that Intel was previously serving?
You got such a big power budget inside a laptop, you can have the T2 and the quote, right, that's my point, regular system on a chip. Like you can combine them, but having them both is not entirely insane. I mean, it's a little bit insane. Like, the thing is that the T2 is basically running the show in the new Mac architecture. Like, it's the thing that starts the computer, and it's the thing that starts the Intel CPU, right? So it is the computer at this point, and the Intel CPU is basically the coprocessor, right? In terms of the secure startup process and validating the images and doing all that stuff, right? So, you know, a cleaner architecture would be, okay, well, now you go to the big honkin' ARM CPU and the Intel one is out of there, and you just need one of those because you put all the different things that you need inside it, whether on a system on a chip or on a, a package with multiple dies inside it or whatever. And there's no reason to have one dedicated little thing that starts up the computer in a secure way and kicks it off to the other thing. You can just combine it into one. But for practical reasons, in the short term, it may be more expedient to go with an arrangement with two ARM chips. The Intel chips, though, the whole point is you got to get them out of there because they cost a lot of money and they use a lot of power, and just, you know, they just need to get them out. Like, we're all hoping that they'll be able to emulate Intel on ARM processors in some way that isn't super duper painful, because that's kind of essential for the transition. Real-time follow-up is an article someone just put in a link to remind us that, I think we talked about this on the show, this is from 2017, that Intel is making Thunderbolt 3 royalty free. I don't know what the details of it. I think they mostly just mean in terms of, if you want to make devices that, you know, use controller chips and stuff like that. Does it also mean if you're going to make host computers? Maybe. Anyway, the point is Intel is already opening up Thunderbolt more than they had in the past, which means that they want it to be widely adopted, which means they're even more amenable to any kind of arrangement they might need with Apple to, you know, again, if Apple says, we're not going to buy CPUs from you anymore, Intel, although they'll be cranky, is probably going to say, well, you'll still buy modems from us, right? Or, you know, sell modem chips. Are you interested in licensing, you know, some sort of Thunderbolt controller chip or technology that we have? Like, Intel still needs to sell things, right? They're not, if they can't, once they've failed to change Apple's mind, they're not just going to go away and never have a relationship with Apple again. They still want to sell Apple stuff so they can make money and stay in business, because Apple's got all the money. So I'm very hopeful about a continuing fruitful relationship between Intel and Apple in areas where it needs to exist.
We are sponsored this week by Fracture, who prints your photos directly onto glass. Visit fractureme.com/ATP for a special discount on your first Fracture order. Almost everyone takes and shares pictures, but very few of those pictures these days end up actually being printed, and even fewer end up being displayed anywhere. Focus on the moments that mean the most in your life by turning your favorite digital memories into meaningful photo decor. Fracture prints are made by printing directly on glass and come ready to display right out of the box. They even include the wall hanger if you need that. Fracture prints are awesome. They're all over my office, all over my house. They also make incredibly good gifts for almost anyone. So these are a must-have for your holiday shopping list. And please, if you want to get a holiday order in for Fracture, hurry up and do it soon, because all fracture prints are handmade by human beings, by nice people in Gainesville, Florida, from U.S. source materials in a carbon-neutral factory. They're a green company. This also means that in the holidays, because they're, you know, human-made, they can get backed up. And so if you want a really great holiday gift, and fractures do make amazing gifts, you want to get that order in ASAP. So check it out today at fractureme.com/ATP. That will get you a special discount on your first fracture order. And again, I can highly recommend these. They're all over our house. We've given a lot of them as gifts. People love them. They look great. The glass is edge to edge. The print goes edge to edge. And it's not heavy glass. It's very lightweight glass. You don't have to worry about like difficulties hanging it. I've never had one break in the mail. They're very well packaged. Of course, they have great support if anything happens, but I don't think it will. So once again, check it out today. Fractureme.com/ATP. That will get you a special discount on your first order. And don't forget to tell them that you came from here. They will ask a one-question survey after checkout that basically says, what show sent you here? Make sure to pick ATP. Thanks again to Fracture for sponsoring our show.
All right, so last week, Marco, you had a pre-release iPad Pro or a review unit iPad Pro. Since then, John, did you buy any other new Apple hardware other than that MacBook Air?
Nope, just the MacBook Air. I haven't even seen the new iPads. I need to get to a store and look at them.
Man, it's like you don't do homework for the show. Why don't you care about the show like Marco and I do?
I'm busy. I got things to do.
I have also purchased an iPad Pro. I've purchased an iPad for the first time. Well, actually, my most recent iPad Mini was a gift, so I haven't purchased an iPad since, gosh, I think the first Retina Mini, whenever that was, like 18 years ago. But I purchased an 11-inch iPad Pro, 256, cellular, space gray. I did get the Smart Keyboard Folio, and I am glad that I wasn't paying close attention to how much it was, because holy Moses, what was it, $180 or something like that?
Yeah, it's something like that,
Hilariously expensive, actually depressingly expensive. I did not get a pencil, because I don't think I really have a need for one, and maybe I'll be convinced I'm wrong. Plus, you know, the holidays are coming up, and that could be an expensive but useful gift. But I do have this iPad Pro. Did I say it was cellular? It is cellular, because even though I was planning not to go cellular this time, eventually, Marco, amongst others, convinced me, Marco and Jason Snell, especially convinced me that that was a poor choice. And certainly my own experience for buying iPads for the first few years is that when I didn't go cellular, I regretted it. So I did go cellular. People in the US, interesting tip, if you're cheap like me and don't want to add, you know, 10 or 20 bucks monthly to your cell phone bill, T-Mobile actually allows you at least once, I don't know if it's more than once, to buy for $10 one time to buy, I think it's a 5 gig, 5 month pass. So it's like one of those, you know, I want it just for today and then it disappears, or I want it just for this week or this month and then it disappears, you know, a prepay plan. But T-Mobile offers you a 5 gig for 5 months for $10, which is, I think, an unbelievably good deal. And I am really excited about that. T-Mobile in the past had offered 200 megs for free every single month, which they don't do anymore, which is too bad. And because everyone will ask, why not tether to your phone? Because even with it being easy enough to just go into settings and say, tether to my own iPhone, please, that is still way more annoying than just having it built into the iPad. And yes, it is possible. And yes, I do still tether this to my phone from time to time, say if I'm watching a video or something like that. But Marco, in private conversations with me, and Jason Snell in private conversations with me, were right. Having cellular is so much nicer. So that's what I bought. And I have some more impressions or some thoughts about it. But Marco, why don't you tell us what you've learned since we spoke last week?
I don't really have much else to say about the iPad. I did a whole video review of it. I like it a lot. I mean, I've been using it now for, you know, about a little over a week now. And, you know, it's not perfect. There's some things that I, you know, obviously there's some nitpicks I have. The new Smart Keyboard Folio is better in some ways, but worse in others. So I think it's overall kind of a sidestep. Like it's way better on your lap than the previous one, but it's not as good like on countertops. So that's kind of eh. It also is significantly bulkier around the back, which I don't love. But actually using the new iPad, I just think it's awesome. Like I love using it. I love the way it looks. I love the way it feels. It's just really, really nice. Face ID, just like on the iPhone, Face ID is kind of a mixed bag, but mostly positive. I do frequently cover up the camera with the way I hold it in landscape, but I also, but it's also like way faster than Touch ID at, in other cases, or it's more convenient in other cases. It's especially more convenient when you are using the iPad and have to authenticate for things like passwords. It's really, really nice for that because you don't even have to move your hands. Like, it just sees you and it's like, oh, hey, it's still you. Okay, cool. Let's you in. That's really nice. It is still a massive fingerprint magnet. The oleophobic coating has not changed at all. So it is still the same fingerprint magnet that the previous generation was, that every iPad Pro has been, because they changed their coating to make it pencil compatible. And ever since they did that, it has been a massive fingerprint magnet. So that's incredibly unfortunate. But, you know, I'm assuming that Apple has that, you know, like, you know, they're not like unaware of this issue, that maybe they just haven't found a better oleophobic coating yet that can work with a pencil. Otherwise, I'm a big fan. I like it a lot. I love the new size, the new 11-inch size. It's similar to the 10.5, but nicer. I love the new straight edges, the, you know, the flat edges around it. I love the curved screen. It's just, it looks really sleek and modern, and I really, really hope that the new iPhones next year follow this industrial design.
Yeah, so like I'd said, my most recent iPad that we had in the house was a fourth-gen iPad mini. So this was the most recent iPad mini. I think it was from 2015, if I'm not mistaken. So that was halfway through this show's run, roughly, which is kind of bananas. And I still use the iPad mini from time to time, but had mostly abandoned it at this point. And I did get this iPad Pro because the hardware was just too good looking and too sexy to pass up. And so I got it on launch day. I just sauntered into the store and made it happen, thanks to my business contact there. And anyways, I am really enjoying this thing so far. I did not have any iPad Pro in the past, and so I didn't have a lot of experience with the smart keyboard folio, whatever thing from prior years. But I remember always seeing it and seeing how it was kind of stepped, and, you know, there was a thick part and a thin part, and that always just made me think that it felt gross. And this one is even the whole way around. It is pretty sturdy in the lap, which my understanding of past years is that that was not the case.
Correct.
On the 11-inch, I don't care for the two angles very much. They're basically two different positions you can put it in. One that's kind of vertical and one that's at a very slight angle. And the vertical one, the only time I've really used that is if I'm in bed and watching something. So I'm laying down in bed and the iPad is just like on my chest. And that's about it. The other one is for basically any other use. And I wish there was a third one or something with a little bit steeper angle, because if you're sitting up close to it and, you know, your head is considerably above the screen, I don't feel like the angle of the other position is really steep enough, which is a little frustrating. But overall, I love this thing. I am really surprised by how much I've enjoyed using it. And I took it with me on a small trip that we went on over this past weekend to watch some dear friends of ours get married. And I brought my MacBook Adorable. I brought my 12-inch MacBook. But I attempted to use that 12-inch MacBook as little as possible. And I took some notes on what I couldn't avoid using the MacBook for. And truth be told, it really wasn't that much. I even figured out on the plane to California, I figured out how to post to my blog from just the iPad. And so, or actually maybe that was the night before, I might be lying to you. So, but the point is, I figured out how to post to my blog on my iPad. And that turned out to be the app Working Copy, which is a really powerful Git client for iPad. It's a little, I find the interface a little bit clunky in a few ways, but it is extremely powerful. And it even includes a built-in and pretty good Markdown editor. And if you recall, or if you were not aware, I wrote my own blogging engine in Node years ago, and the input to that blogging engine is basically just a folder full of Markdown files. And so I was able to compose a Markdown file in Working Copy. I was able to push that to GitHub, and then I was able to create, I use Heroku as my particular host of choice, and I was able to create a hook in Heroku to say, hey, when I push to this particular branch of this particular repo in GitHub, go ahead and redeploy my website. And so twice for two different blog posts I wrote on my website, I did that from the plane, all completely on the iPad, which is something that I hadn't really been able to do before and I thought was extremely cool. The only things that really fell down are, and we talked about this actually somewhat recently, the particular app I use to manage our, to kind of balance our checkbook, if you will, and manage our money is called Moneywell. It is, I like it a lot, except it is not updated terribly frequently, and they don't really have a sharing story that's been consistently working for sharing between devices. And so I don't really have an equivalent on the iPad. And the best I could do is using Screens by some friends of ours, which is a VNC client. I could, you know, remote into my iMac and do that, but that's fairly clunky, not because Screens is bad. Screens is fantastic. It's just that's always going to be clunkier than, you know, doing something on an app on your device. Now, additionally, there was an instance where I wanted to grab a movie from actually a friend's Plex, and I didn't have the sync permissions on that person's Plex server. But if you know what you're doing and have YouTube DL, which is one of my favorite command line tools in the entire world, you can actually download pretty much anything on a friend's Plex server via YouTube DL. And though somebody in just the last week or two, or I guess just the last few days, has released ISH via Test Flight, which is a iOS Linux shell in user land, which is really interesting.
Really?
Yes. And I tried installing YouTube DL, which did work, but the second I tried to run it, what? It was like, no. So
I am very interested in that.
Yeah, it is very interesting. It reminds me a lot in spirit, and I'm sure this is technically inaccurate, but it reminds me of a lot in spirit of Cygwin, CYGWIN, which was basically a bash, an interpreter between bash and the Win32 subsystem. So you could basically run, you know, almost true to form bash shell on Windows. And ISH seems very, very similar. We'll put links in the show notes. So for certain things you can do, if you're doing more basic stuff that the author/authors have intended or tried, you know, it works okay. So like VI works, but my preferred editor, which happens to be Emacs, please don't at me. That
wait,
doesn't
really?
Work.
What?
It's what I got used to before. Oh, I knew God. What I was doing, and I've got a lot of momentum there, and I don't care passionately about it. Whatever, it's just what I'm used to. So anyway,
might be worse than Velveeta.
Well, I'm okay with that. So anyway, I'm trying not to get derailed. I couldn't do YouTube DL from my iPad, and I had to do that on my MacBook. And the reason I wanted to do that, not just stream it from Plex, which I absolutely can do on my iPad, is because I wanted to prepare to be able to watch it on the plane. And so this way I would just have the file on my MacBook and be able to just watch it on the plane, you know, disconnected. And then finally, I do have a USB-C SD card reader that does work pretty darn well. However, it does not show the particular flavor of RAW files that my camera generates. And this is important, not because I necessarily want to do any editing of RAW files on my iPad. And frankly, I don't really do any editing of RAW files anyway. But I do shoot in RAW and JPEG. And basically, my workflow is, if there's anything I think I might want to blow up or maybe touch up one day in the future, I'll keep the RAW. But generally speaking, I just delete all of them. And what I'd like to be able to do on the iPad is just, you know, tap through and say, that one's garbage, that one's garbage, that one's garbage, that one's garbage. Okay, delete all those off the SD card and move along with your life. And that doesn't seem to be possible because I think because of the particular flavor of RAW files that my Olympus camera generates. From what I understand, that is not true of every camera's RAW files. I just got unlucky. So all told, I spent the entire weekend remotely, you know, doing things that you could even call work, all on my iPad. And as I got more and more used to the multitasking features in iOS, well, I guess it was like 9 or 10 or whatever that these came out, but I hadn't really used them much. It's pretty powerful, and I do like it a lot. It is not always as quick as my MacBook is, but especially now that I actually have a keyboard attached to my iPad, because again, I've never had an iPad Pro before. It is, and this is what Marco actually had said just an episode or two back. Once you have a keyboard connected to your iPad Pro, it changes everything and makes it so much better a computer than it was before. So all told, two thumbs up for this thing, man. I really, really like it. And I can't stress enough, and I think I said this last episode, I am really looking forward to iOS 13 or whatever's coming next year, because I just get this sneaking suspicion that a lot of these pain points are either going to go away or be a lot less painful in the future.
I still just want to use my iPad as an iPad, and I'm still holding out hope for an iOS laptop. Like, you know, I understand the utility of having the keyboard. I mean, my wife uses it, and I totally get it. But, like, to me, like, as good as it is and how much it changes how the iPad is, I think it would be better still if it was an actual, you know, hinge laptop thing, you know, like Jason Snell's beloved Bridge keyboard, but made by Apple and not two separate weird things. Like, not that I have a yearning for that, but I feel like that's the point at which I will start entertaining putting a keyboard on it, because in my life, the role that the iPad fills is the role of the tablet, where I do stuff that doesn't require typing on a keyboard. Although I do answer short emails and stuff and send people messages or whatever, and that's fine. But the whole point is, when I'm using the iPad, I'm not in the computing mode. Now, if I was to go somewhere and, you know, only bring my iPad with me, as I've done did I do it past a couple WWDCs? I don't even remember. I only really use my iPad at WWDCs, but I'm not doing any typing anymore at WWDC. I'm mostly just reading things and sending random messages or whatever. So I'm still a little bit down in the hole. This turns your iPad into a heavier iPad with a floppy keyboard. So that's still not particularly appealing to me. But I do want to check out this new one because, you know, it, although as Marco determined, it is heavier, but it's also flatter and not as lumpen and... Maybe I'll change my tune. But you know, and I would still love to have one of these. Just not sure I have a pressing need to buy one quite at this moment. I do want to see them in the store. Maybe I'll be convinced otherwise, especially since the accessories that I was so excited about, the, you know, the Smart Folio case that's getting, you know, kind of mixed reviews, not the keyboard one, but the non-keyboard one, mixed reviews as compared to the old arrangement. And my current arrangement that I have, in the whatever model I have, like the original 9.7-inch iPad Pro, I have the smart cover, plain old, you know, original smart cover that just goes in the front, and whatever that back shell case is, and they're matched to each other, they're the same color, and they're all this kind of rubberized material. I really love that arrangement. I would love it more if it didn't make the iPad wider and taller, because it goes all around the edges, so that's why I think I like the protective sandwich, as the past episode was called. But mixed reviews I'm hearing from people about the material of the case and how it compares to the old ones, and weird issues with the bazillion magnets. So I got to go to the store and check them out. But I think I'll be able to hold off buying one.
You know, I really, really like it. And again, I can't stress enough that I do not have a prior gen to really compare to. But I really like the case. I don't think the materials are bad. I think it works pretty well, again, with my small lamentation about angles, particularly on the 11-inch. However, something that I couldn't put my finger on until I read Jason Snell's review that just came out earlier today as we record, is that it is just this like grand expanse of gray that is the cover, in fact, like that when you close it all up and are looking at what would be the front of the iPad if the cover wasn't in the way, it's just nothing but gray. There's no ridges. There's not just a slab of gray. And I couldn't figure out why I kept looking at that and thinking I should put a sticker on this, because that is not usually my thing. I did on my work laptop, because who cares? It's not mine. But I've never stickered up any of my devices, and I'm really thinking about stickering the hell out of this Mike Hurley style, because it's just gray. It's just a slab of gray, and I don't really love it.
Yeah, like for a device that is so, you know, creative focused and artistic focused and so fun in so many other ways, the design of the you know, dark gray, flat, bland keyboard cover that doesn't even have an Apple logo on it. Like there was a good segment on Upgrade about this a few days ago, or yesterday rather. It's like, and also like the new cover design also like picks up any crumbs off your counter, because like it's just this like flat rubber like I have right here. It just looks so bland. Like it looks like it is punishing you for wanting nice looking things, and it's such a contrast to the iPad itself, which is just ridiculously exactly. Nice looking. Like the iPad, the actual iPad looks gorgeous. Like it's such an amazing piece of industrial design. And then you put this ugly keyboard case on it that looks like it's punishing you.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not as, I don't know if I would personally describe it as actively ugly, but it is certainly not great looking. And I think I will probably end up putting some stickers on mine at some point or another. But now, all in all, I do love having a keyboard attached to an iPad, and I also do love the industrial design of this iPad. I love having the flat sides. It reminds me of how much I miss the feel and to some degree the look of like the iPhone 5 era with the flat sides. I wish that would come back on new iPhones, and I don't think it will, or if it does, I'll be surprised. But I do love having the flat sides. Occasionally, I stand by what I had said about being a little bit of a pain to pick up off a flat surface, but that's not something I run into often. But no, I love this thing. I've been impressed by it. The sound is good, is pretty darn good. Again, I have a 3-year-old mini to compare to, so all of these comparisons, you know, take with a grain of salt. But the sound is good. The screen is good. Face ID is wonderful. You know, it everything about this, I've been really, really impressed by.
Speaking of picking it up, I think someone tweeted at us a video of an alternate technique for, you know, if you want to pick up your 11-inch anyway iPad Pro off the table with one hand. If you can manage it, you can put one finger on one side and one finger and your thumb on the other side and pinch it and pick it up like that. I guess if you can palm a basketball, you can probably pull that off. But if not,
my word, yeah, no way.
Can you do it?
Not even close.
So no. I actually can pick it up with one hand, only if the keys part of it is face down. So it creates a little bit bigger of a gap. So if the keys are on the bottom side, and the keyboard cover is closed, and I put my hands around like the binding side of it, then I can pick it up with one hand.
Oh, actually, you know what? I was looking at the wrong dimension. I was looking landscape like an idiot. No, I can almost get it up. Yeah, you're right. I can almost do it. I can almost do it. It's close.
Yeah, if you have the 12.9-inch, it would take quite a finger span to pull that off, but it's possible.
That's bananas. But anyway, no, I really like this thing. I've been quite impressed by it. The only problem I have with it is now that I see that ISH is a thing, now I'm just like waiting for it to support the just handful of things I really want it to support, which it probably never will, but I would love for that to happen. And certainly in a lot of cases, I can just use, what is Panic's thing? Is it Prompt? Is that right?
Prompt, yeah.
I can just use Prompt and SSH into my iMac, but it would be nice to be able to do some of that stuff locally. And I think one of the things that the developer, and this is all open source, but one of the things the developer is looking to do is support Node, for example. And I think PHP might have support. I'm not sure about that. But it would be cool to be able to, you know, write a little bit of code natively on this device. And so
write some scripts too, put image magic on it and like do some scripting. Like, yes, yeah, so, like there's all sorts of stuff I could do with this.
Don't you get an incredibly uncomfortable feeling? Like, you know, there's Unix under there that you could be running an actual shell on the actual hardware, but Apple doesn't let you. So here, to get around all the App Store restrictions, they're running a user mode x86 emulator so that you can run in shell inside it on a system that is already
not a lot of empathy for the machine.
I it's ridiculous. Like, this is another, I know Jason Snell had a rant on the most recent upgrade. I haven't heard the episode, but I've heard a lot of people talk about it, complaining that, you know, the iPad hardware, you know, the theme that we've heard many times, the iPad hardware is amazing, but the software doesn't, the software prevents certain things still. He was complaining that Apple doesn't create its own Pro applications for the iPad. It just gives you the more cut-down versions of it, which doesn't make any sense given the incredible power of the iPad Pro, other than Apple's general lack of commitment to its Pro applications, lack of commitment to them on iOS anyway. And this is another one of the areas. All the restrictions, which make some sense for historic and current security reasons, but like that you can't offer an iOS application that lets you run a shell, even though those capabilities are sitting there, or, you know, completely untapped inside the hardware. Again, makes sense from a security perspective, but it is entirely within the reason for Apple to provide ability to have sort of a CH-rooted, secure, sandboxed environment where you run a native shell that nevertheless is restricted from doing any damage to the system because it is confined to its little penned-in world or whatever, where you don't have to run an x86 emulator on your ARM CPU just so you can get a shell prompt. Like you mentioned Cygwin. I don't think Cygwin was that bad, but it reminds me of, going back even farther, Mac Mint, which was a system that I believe it was like a port of an Atari Unix-y flavored thing to the 68K classic Mac. And the whole reason I ran it on my Mac was, guess what? It lets you have a TCSH prompt on your Mac that you could, you know, go and wander around your Mac's directories from an actual shell running this weird mutant Atari Unix on top of your Mac. But classic Mac OS wasn't a Unix, didn't have a shell prompt. Like, that's the, you know, same thing with Windows. Like, it wasn't on top of something that was already there. It was adding something that didn't exist at all. And this, the ISH thing, I applaud the developer for making it happen, but it depresses me that this is the extent we have to go to get this functionality when it's just sitting right there, just completely untapped.
Yeah, I think that's fair. But it is cool as hell, and I'm really hopeful now that it's getting some attention, you know, because Steve Sean Smith has been talking about this for the last day or so. I'm hopeful, since it's open source, that we're going to see a lot of progress on this and maybe get a reasonably full-featured shell natively on the iPad, which would be cool.
We are sponsored this week by Linode. You can get a $20 credit when you visit linode.com/ATP and use promo code ATP2018. Linode lets you instantly deploy and manage an SSD server in the Linode cloud. You can get a server running in seconds with your choice of Linux distro, resources, node location, and so much more. Linode has 10 data centers around the world for you to put your nodes in. Plans start at just $5 a month. That gets you 1 gig of RAM. And of course, they have all sorts of plans above and beyond that, depending on what your needs are, including high memory plans starting at 16 gigs of RAM. You can get a server running in under a minute. And all of these wonderful plans, and great values too, have hourly billing by default, and then there's a monthly cap. So you never have to worry about whether you're picking the right billing mode or whether you're spending too much. You always know what your budget is here. And let me tell you, I've used Linode myself for something like 8 years, and they're just great. I love them. I have all my stuff hosted there now because they've just blown away every other web host for me. Not only is it a great value, like I can't find a better value on a sustained basis in the hosting industry. So not only is it the best value I've seen, but it's also just really nice to use. They have a really nice control panel. Their support is top-notch on the very few times I've actually needed to contact them for anything. And it's just a real pleasure to use. And I've used a lot of web hosts before. And let me tell you, Linode really is a wonderful pleasure to use. It's also just good hardware, good software. They have native enterprise-grade SSD storage, 40 gigabit network, Xeon E5 processors. So, you know, this is really top-notch stuff at a really great price. So check it out today. Also, if you happen to be looking for a job in the hosting field, Linode is hiring. If that interests you, go to linode.com/careers. Otherwise, you can get a $20 credit when you visit linode.com/ATP and use promo code ATP2018. On that $5 a month plan, that could be 4 months free. So that's pretty cool. $20 credit when you visit linode.com/ATP using promo code ATP2018. Thank you to Linode for sponsoring our show.
John, tell me about your MacBook Air. What else have you learned about it?
Yeah, I guess we kind of already covered that. I mean, I haven't learned that much exciting about it. It hasn't yet been dropped. Kids are using it. They don't seem to have any complaints. Touch ID is great. Kids are already forgetting their passwords.
Oh, wonderful.
Also, because apparently in a recent user version of, I don't know when they started doing this, but Apple doesn't want you to have the same password for your Apple ID and for your Mac account. And for a while, that was the default, I think, maybe, like that you'd set up your Apple ID. I don't know. It both kids ended up in a situation where their password to get onto the Mac was the same as their Apple ID password, which I understand why Apple doesn't want it. It's not a good idea. You shouldn't reuse passwords. But anyway, now Apple forces you not to do that. So now they have slightly different passwords for the Mac and for their Apple ID. But because there's Touch ID, they never have to enter the Mac one. Like, they just swap back and forth. They come up to the computer. They don't even need to click on their face or whatever. They just put their finger on the fingerprint thing, and their fingerprint is only associated with a single account, and it just logs them into that account. And it's great. And yeah, so it's as great as it is, though. It still kind of burns me that we don't have Touch ID in a Mac yet. So hopefully that will be on my fancy Mac Pro someday. But other than that, no, nothing much to report. Everything going fine. Oh, well, I guess one additional thing is MagSafe. Stupid MagSafe. Not that anyone's tripped over the cord, but now, you know, we have a place for the laptop. It goes right where the old MacBook Air went. Two things that are pretty big quality of life downgrades from before, and neither has to do with tripping over the cord. One, I was using the MagSafe adapter that was designed for the original MacBook Air that couldn't accept MagSafe that came in from the side. It's the kind that looks kind of like a toothbrush that comes in from the back.
Yes.
Right? And that was super convenient because the most convenient place for the cord to go away was back behind the desk that the thing is sitting on for me. It also meant that enough of the cord was on top of the desk that when you disconnected the laptop, the cord just sat right there waiting for you to bring the laptop back and put it on. Like, it didn't like slide off the desk because there was enough of it pulled onto the desk.
Yeah, that was a much nicer design to use.
Yeah, so that's totally gone because USB-C had, if there's a right angle USB-C power adapter connector, I haven't found it yet. I think Monoprice has a couple. I looked at them, but they're like ugly adaptery things. Like, it's not a kind of an all-in-one. You know, it's just not as nice. Second thing is, given that now the plug has to snake up from the side, when you disconnect the laptop, that cord just slides right off and goes back down the side of the desk because there's not enough of it on the desk. Now, I actually have a little weighted metal thing that you like hook the cord into that we're kind of using, but because the cord is so thick and kind of unruly, it doesn't really stay in the little thing doesn't grab it. It's not like a grippy thing. It's more like just a little slot, right? So it's not easy for the kids to disconnect the cord and put it in the thing. So very often the cord just falls down the side of the desk. I'm working on something to make that more reasonable, maybe something that actually grips the cord. The third thing is actually connecting and disconnecting the USB-C thing is more of a pain than MagSafe was. For me, definitely, like, you got to see where the little thing is, and I'm trying to be careful not to scrape up the side of the computer, and it's actually, because it's a new computer and a new power cord, it's still very stiff, right? To go, you know, it clicks in, and it's actually kind of hard to plot. I'm sure that will change as as the cable gets looser and looser over time.
It will.
Right? But right now, it's very stiff to get in and out of there, and you have to pull it out straight, right? Because it's not, you know, you can't, like, pull it on an angle, because it's not going to come out, and you're just making your life more difficult. And the kids have much more difficulty than I do with it, and because they're not as careful as I am, and the holes are very small, and you have to be precisely aligned, they're just like scrape, 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 until it eventually goes in, which just puts my teeth on edge. So, big downgrade in terms of the basic experience of, hey, go put the laptop away and plug it in, or hey, go get the laptop. I'll figure out the cord issues, but the plugging and unplugging, I feel like, is not going to get any better. In fact, it's probably going to get worse, and that the thing will get looser and looser, so it'll, you know, come out more easily than it does right now. Like, I kind of like the fact that it stays in very well right now because everything's new, because I don't have to worry about, you know, someone moving the laptop around and it becoming disconnected, but, ugh, you know, downgrade.
To that end, something I meant to bring up earlier and I completely forgot. I haven't really noticed this with USB-C charging cables quite as much, but when plugging in the Apple, whatever they call it, the Apple HDMI adapter, I forget what it's called, the official name for it.
The digital AV adapter, maybe?
Yeah, I think that's it. Thanks. And the Monoprice SD card reader that probably cost me $10 or $15. But plugging those into the iPad Pro, plugging it in was fine, but removing them was actually like genuinely difficult. The iPad Pro is more grippy than I remember the MacBook Adorable ever having been. And I don't know if it's just me and I'm crazy. I was talking to, I think it was Gruber about this, and he said that he had seen a lot of the same, but I'm curious, you know, if the listeners find that the iPad Pros are also much grippier. Like, Marco, have you noticed this with things other than power cables, or have you only really plugged in power cables so far?
I mean, this is just what USB-C feels like. You know, USB-C is, you know, it takes more effort to pull out the cable than Lightning and than most cables when the cables are new. Over time, the cable ends, like the pins inside of them, do wear down and get easier to pull out, often to a fault where they stop making good connections and you have to replace the cable, or at least like turn it around if it's a C2C cable. But that is a thing that happens, and they do start out really tight.
I mean, I haven't ever noticed my Switch, my GoPro, or my MacBook Adorable, all of which are USB-C. I've never noticed them grip onto something nearly as much as the iPad Pro has. And it was striking how much of a difference it was with the same like dongles. Cause I use that same, you know, digital AV adapter with my MacBook, and the MacBook's, you know, barely holding onto it. And again, it's a year older. So your point is fair, Marco, but I can't verbalize how strong a hold this thing had on my dongle. This is going nowhere good.
That's another thing about things being hard to pull out. It just encourages kids to pull by the cord even more.
Yeah. Right?
Because it is hard to pull out and because they're kids and have no patience, like any chance I had of them, you know, trying to get them to pull any cord out by the stiff part of the connector, which is the correct way you should do it, people who are destroying your cords, they're like, forget it. They've just totally abandoned any pretense of ever trying to do that. And with MagSafe, you could basically yank by the cord because you just learn to kind of yank on an angle and it disconnects, right? Like it's, you know, they have not destroyed any MagSafe connector that we've had in the house, which is quite a feat because they've destroyed many, many lightning cables, right? but I'm not sure how the USB-C cord is going to hold up. We'll see.
All right. Thanks to our sponsors this week, Fracture, Linode, and Change the Terms. And we'll talk to you next week.
Now the show is over. They didn't even mean to begin because it was accidental. Oh, it was accidental. John didn't do any research. Marco and Casey wouldn't let him, cause it was accidental. Oh, it was accidental. And you can find the show notes at atp.fm. And if you're into Twitter, you can follow them at CASEYLISS. So that's Casey Liss, MARCO. ARMENT Marco Arment SIRAC USA Syracuse. It's accidental. They didn't mean to. Accidental. Tech podcast. So long.
So, Marco, you have become Mr. YouTube, my friend. What's going on here?
Yeah, I decided to get back on YouTube and start making more videos.
How's recording audio for YouTube these days?
Recording, it's not bad. Syncing it was pretty bad the first time.
What happened?
All right, so in between the recording of the last episode and this one, I released two YouTube videos. They each had their own issues. The Mac Mini review came first. That one I had severe audio sync issues, and I'll tell you why in a minute. But for the most part, otherwise, it was fairly decent. I had fewer issues overall than my other video 2 years ago when I reviewed the first Touch Bar MacBook Pro. A few technical things that I learned in making these videos. The Mac Mini video, I shot entirely with my iPhone XS. Every bit of video in that is shot on my iPhone, including the main, like, you know, sit down in front of the camera and talk to it video, which involved a teleprompter.
Fancy.
It's not a fancy teleprompter. It is a very inexpensive bracket with a reflective piece of glass on top of it that you put an iPad under. And the iPad was not included in the price of the teleprompter. And I was using Joe Jaquinski's excellent Teleprompt Plus software to display the prompts and control them and everything. And because the problem I had with my 2016 MacBook Pro video, the biggest problem was that I was basically reading off of a keynote presentation running on a laptop that was like next to the camera, down below a bit on a table. And so you can see in that video that I'm constantly looking to like, you know, stage left, basically. You know, looking down to the left a little bit because that's where my like bullet points were that I was reading from, and it was, you know, not great, pretty distracting, you know, not particularly useful. And so I bought the teleprompter right after making that video, and it sat in the box for 2 years because I never made another video after that until like, you know, last week or whatever. So when it came time to make a new video, I decided, you know, great, I'll do it right with teleprompter this time. You know, I'll write out bullet points of what I want to say and have them actually on the screen and be shooting through it. And that way, you know, I'm looking at the camera while reading the text. And that actually worked fairly well for the Mac Mini video. The interesting thing is, like, behind the teleprompter is basically like a big black nylon bag that, like, you put the camera into so the camera doesn't see reflections on the back of the teleprompt screen. And that works fine when it's a camera lens that you're sticking in that black bag. It's really clumsy when it's an iPhone because you have to reach into it to see the screen and to push the buttons on the iPhone and everything. But I wanted to see if I could make the whole video with just my iPhone as the only video camera. And indeed, with the Mac Mini video, I did. I didn't with the iPad video. I'll get to that in a second. I also decided I wanted to shoot all the B-roll and everything with my iPhone because it's just easier. And you know, a lot of it was using like a stand with a clip on the end of it. Like basically it's like an iPhone holding clip on the end of it's actually a microphone stand with a couple of little screw adapters to make that work. You know, I had the stand so I could like, you know, put it on the stand and then I can like hold the thing and move it around and get good B-roll with the camera being steady. And then also with the Mac Mini video, I took a lot of shots where the camera was moving, like panning around something, and I did most of those using my gimbal, which is another thing I bought 2 years ago and almost never used. I learned a few things in making that first video. Number one, I learned that I really like the app Filmic Pro that we talked about before. It was very, very nice to have an app that had all the manual video controls readily accessible and everything else. And I shot all my B-roll using Filmic Pro for the Mac Mini review, and it was just fantastic. And I shot the main video as well. One of the things you can do with Filmic Pro is record video without audio. I figured, well, I'm recording the audio onto my audio recorder. I don't need the audio from the video.
Oh, Marco.
So the result was that the audio recorder had my audio track. The video had no audio, and therefore Final Cut could not automatically sync the audio to the video. Now, I thought, well, I edit podcasts. I know how to sync up audio. It's no big deal. I'll sync it up. It'll take, you know, 5 minutes, and it'll be fine. Unfortunately, for whatever reason, I don't know why, there was ridiculous drift. And that is, that for anybody who doesn't know, that is basically when, like, you know, the audio basically doesn't match the duration of the video. Even after you line it up, like, you'll have to like realign it at many different points because it'll just like, you can sync it up at one point, but then like a minute later it'll be out of sync, and so you have to like cut it somewhere and then move it around so it's in sync again. And I had ridiculous drift. I don't know why, but it doesn't matter. And I tried to sync it up so much, and I synced up so many things. And like I think I had in the, I think like 8 minute Mac Mini video, I think I had like 10 sync positions. It was ridiculous. And I just couldn't quite get it right. And that's why when I published the final video, it was just the audio sync was off. And that's a huge technical problem with it. It is my one major regret with that video is that the audio sync is not good. Now, if you happen to record the video on the camera with just like, you know, recording off the camera mic, which sounds like garbage, but if you happen to record that with the video and you have an audio track recorded by a nice microphone or audio recorder somewhere, Final Cut will automatically sync that up with, like, you know, you right click on the clips and you say synchronize, and it works seemingly perfectly, which I did on the second video, so I know now. But yeah, so the audio sync on the Mac Mini video was a mess, and that's why, because I didn't record the audio with the video because I was using Filmic Pro, and I didn't record audio for any of the B-roll shots because I didn't, you know, I wasn't going to use it. I was going to use the one continuous take of audio from my, like, you know, stand-up shot, even though I was sitting down, but I think they call it a stand-up, and then, you know, the B-roll shots are going to be silent, and I didn't enable the audio recording for that big long sit-down shot, and I should have.
Yep, that is not fun, and I have a pretty bananas setup for when I do car stuff, which actually coincidentally I am going to be doing that all day tomorrow if all goes according to plan. But one thing I've learned is that whenever I start recording, this is outside or in a car where there's a lot of noise typically. Whenever I start recording, I, you know, start recording the audio, I start recording the video, I walk to wherever I'm supposed to be, or, you know, sit down in the car, whatever the case may be, and I clap my hands one time very loudly to make sure that every audio recording, both the video audio and the, you know, the lavalier audio, hears that clap, so it gives something for Final Cut to sync against when I go to do the edit. And to your point, when you do have something like that, when you've done the small things you need to do on your end to give Final Cut what it needs, it is like freaking magic how it can put these things together. It is unreal how good a job it can do. But if you don't give it, you know, that tool, if you don't give it the audio to sync off of, then you're screwed, as you now know and have lived through. But having yep. having been through videos with crappy audio, I'm just glad that I am not alone in this.
So, yeah.
Welcome to the club.
And I had, you know, I really wanted my audio to sound good. I did, you know, my first MacBook Pro video 2 years ago, I was using a lavalier mic. and it was a decent prosumer one, the Rodelink wireless and whatever mic comes with that. And I honestly hate the Rodelink wireless. Because it's not a pro wireless setup, even though it costs almost as much as one. It uses 2.4 gigahertz as the radio spectrum instead of like one of the TV signal ones that the other ones use. And so there's just constant interference from everything. Like it's just not a very good setup. So I didn't want to reuse that, although I did try, because the issue with getting good sound out of a microphone on video, the microphone matters to some degree, but what matters a lot more is proximity to your mouth. And I've told you this as you're making your videos, like a crappy microphone close to your mouth almost always will sound better, or will be able to sound better than a really good microphone, like, 5 feet away. And so when you're in a video, you basically only have two options. You can, if you don't want some giant mic in the frame, you can either use some kind of lavalier or maybe like some kind of discrete headset thing, which usually is not very discrete. And lavaliers have their own challenges too, like, placement and picking up, if you move your shirt, if you turn your head at all, lavaliers dramatically change the way they sound and dramatically pick you up less or more. So lavaliers have their own issues. And they're also, you can see them. And so if you're trying to have the microphone not be visible, you can pull some tricks with wardrobe to try to hide lavaliers, but you don't always succeed, and it's tricky. And so I tried with the lavalier. I also tried with I have a Sennheiser MKE something, 600 maybe. I bought it 2 years ago. It's like a video microphone that's shotgun style. So I tried that up on a boom. I tried it on the camera. It was too far away. The boom got a little closer. The microphone I ended up using for that. Oh, I even tried like my awesome podcasting microphone, just like, basically boomed above my head, slightly out of frame. What ended up being the best was that Sennheiser MKE whatever on a boom, a little bit out of frame, like basically like above my head, pointing kind of diagonally down at my mouth. That was by far the best audio, but it still wasn't great audio. And, it was still picking up tons from the room. So I tried putting out all my sound dampening panel. Like I have all this acoustic foam because when I bought acoustic foam for the first time, 5 years ago, you could only buy a certain box size. And so I have a lot of extra that just normally lives in the basement. So I brought it upstairs and I basically laid acoustic foam all over the floor of the room. The entire room was covered in acoustic foam panels. And I just trying to reduce reflections around the room and make it sound less echoey so that a microphone that is 2 feet away from my mouth can actually sound like it's closer to my mouth. And I succeeded somewhat. I still ended up post-processing the audio with Isotope to run a little bit of de-reverb, which helped a little bit. I can't use too much of it because it starts sounding weird if you use too much of it. It's kind of artifacty, but I did use a little bit of de-reverb, a little bit of EQ as well, because I'm a audio nerd for podcasting, and so I'm not going to just leave my voice un-EQ'd like an animal. And the combination of those plus a little bit of noise removal, just to get a little bit of, lower the noise floor a little bit, made it sound pretty good. I was pretty happy with it. I wasn't incredibly happy with it, but I was, pretty happy with it. Even though then, of course, I totally missynced it and the audio became the worst thing about the video. But overall, it was a bit of an audio adventure to get that. And I realized after I was setting this up, and I took a picture and I sent it to you guys of the state of my office to do this video. In order to create the Mac Mini video, I basically had to destroy the rest of my office. There was crap everywhere. And part of it's my fault because I had a lot of crap out just because I was working with a lot of crap, during that week. And part of it is just because, I had to unload all this video stuff, take it all out of the closet, unbox the teleprompter, set it all up, have foam panels all over the floor, have lights, on sitting on various things to boost up my light a little bit. It was just a mess. And as I was taking it all down after the shoot was done and I figured I had my take and I reviewed it and looked pretty good and I started the edit and I'm taking all this stuff down and I'm like, I don't want to do videos anymore. This is just
time for another 2 year break.
Yeah.
Buy a bunch of stuff right now, put it in the closet, and 2 years from now you can make some more videos.
Yep. So I was, and this is after the Mac Mini video. So this, I still made the iPad video after, and I'll get to that. But I'm like, this is just way too invasive, way too much setup and tear down. It destroys my office. It's just so much overhead to make a video. But then I started editing it, and I'm like, you know, I'm actually kind of happy with how this is turning out. This is actually pretty decent. And then I posted it, and when I released it, and I did the blog post with it, and I released it, and people loved it. Like, it got a very strong reception, way stronger reception than I thought. And this is for the Mac Mini, which, you know, kind of is not that interesting of a product to most people, I think. So I was blown away by the positive reaction of the Mac Mini video. And I'm like, damn it, I should really make more videos. But I need to make it easier to make videos. Like, I need some kind of, like, something I can leave set up, or at least leave mostly set up. I need, you know, to get better at this, to, you know, to polish my process a little bit, to improve, to fix the issues like the audio sync I had. Just, like, I need to get something. I need to make this easier, because I do actually want to do more of this. And also, I think professionally, I think it's a good idea to, you know, to grow my audience in an area that I don't have one yet. And that area would be YouTube and video and everything. So I decided, fine, I'm going to make this easier. And I talked to Tiff, my wonderful wife, and she suggested rearranging the office to be more amenable to video. And so we basically moved the furniture around in the office, and she said, why don't you just leave the camera, tripod and everything set up? Like, just leave it up. Like, we'll find a place to put it in the office. And so we did. So we like turned the whole office sideways, made, you know, rearranged this whole midsection of the room, and made myself a video set, basically. And that's what you see in the iPad video. Now I can actually make a video with way less setup and way less disruption to the office, and then way less tear down afterwards. What I put in the tripod for the new video setup is one of our Canon 5D Mark IVs. We bought them a couple years ago. Usually Tiff ends up only using one. Like, we bought a pair because the previous 5D Mark IIs, we had a pair, and Tiff used two frequently for shoots. These days, usually she brings the Sony and one 5D Mark II or Mark IV. So we basically have one 5D Mark IV that we don't use very much. So I mounted that like semi-permanently as my video camera in the tripod. Works way better than the teleprompter. I have a nice lens for it that's good for video, a nice 24-70. So I'm like, all right, try number two, iPad video. I'm still shooting all the B-roll with my iPhone because it's just better and easier. But I will set up the Canon, and it's nice too, because like the Canon, I have like a little tiny external monitor. A big shout out to the company Neewer, I think it's pronounced N-E-E-W-E-R. Neewer produces a bunch of cheap video gear, and it's not that bad. In some cases, I would even go as far as to say it's good. Like, they make a bunch of gear that is surprisingly cheap. And so one of the things I wanted to do was, like, I want more permanent lights. Like, the lights I used for the iPad, I have two little lights for the iPad Mini video, both newer lights, but they are battery powered only. And batteries are a pain. And I'm charging batteries and managing and swapping batteries is a pain. And so I was like, you know what? I want to just get two lights I can have on sticks, like, you know, on light stands, that can just plug into the wall, and I can just leave them plugged into the wall most of the time. And when I want to do a video, I can turn them on. And Neewer sells a two-pack for like $150 of these wonderful like LED light panels that can turn between cool and warm color temperature. You can adjust on the back, because basically it's like a panel of alternating white and yellow LEDs. So you're basically adjusting the brightness of either the whites or the yellows, and you can achieve all different color temperatures. And they're super bright. And it was only $150 for two of them with stands and AC adapters. And when I looked at pro lights, it was like $400 for that kind of light, for just the light without the stand. It's like, okay, so this is, I don't need a $400 light yet. I'm not to that point. Hopefully I never get there. So anyway, so I got my new newer lights. I got my camera in my fancy video tripod I bought 2 years ago. And I'm just very, very happy with that setup now. Like, it's easy to turn on. It's easy to set up. I do have a couple of issues with the using the Canon as the video camera. And I don't know what I'm going to do about this yet. I probably should just use the Sony, because it's a way better video camera, but I don't want the Sony to be always tied up in this setup. So I should probably just tolerate the Canon. But the Canon does have a couple of issues that I ran into with the iPad video. Number one, it only records 4K in 29.97 frames per second, which is the old, you know, TV standard. The iPhone records its 30 frames per second as 30 frames per second, exactly 30 frames per second. So I have a slight frame rate difference between my two cameras. So whatever I set the Final Cut Project to, one of them has to be like reinterpolated And so moving around the Final Cut timeline, dropping in the clips, previewing them was way slower when I made the iPad video than when I did all the footage on the phone, and therefore nothing was requiring any kind of frame rate conversion or anything like that. So problem number one is the frame rate between my B-roll camera and the Canon can't match up. At least not if I stick with 4K, which I do want to.
So it was the Canon that got interpolated, right?
I believe I set the project to 30, but I'm not positive.
So I'm just looking at the iPad video now, and now that you mentioned that one of them has interpolation, I'm like, I think it's when Marco's talking on the sitting in the chair.
Well, the other thing is the Canon video, like my tripod wasn't perfectly level, so the Canon shot in the chair, I actually had to rotate it slightly, so it's like 1 degree rotated. So don't judge it on that. And then also, I also learned that, and movie people are always complaining, that things that claim to shoot or display 4K don't actually display 4,000 pixels across. 4K encompasses a number of different resolutions, one of which is 4,096 across. That is what the Canon shoots. And also, and the iPhone shoots at 3840 across, which is, I think, more common. And so I not only did I have a frame rate difference that was annoying, but then as I'm playing with, like, it was like the very last clip I inserted, the very last B-roll clip I inserted, I notice that on the far left and right sides are these thin red strips of the shot behind it showing through.
Oh, yep.
And I realized, oh, crap. And I looked back, and every single one of my B-roll clips didn't quite fill the frame that the Canon made. So I had to go through and basically zoom every B-roll clip by, like, you know, 5% or something, and then make sure it fit, like, you know, pan it slightly to make sure it fits, you know, make sure nothing's weird getting cut off and everything. And also, the Canon only records video at 4K in motion JPEG, which means that a, you know, like the 9 minute or 10 minute raw file of that shot was like 60 gigs. And took Final Cut a very long time to render at full resolution, like in the preview window. And it also takes a long time to pull off of SD cards and everything. And so it's just like, working with the Canon as the video camera is cumbersome, and I'm going to have to do something about the frame rate issue, I think, if I want that to, you know, to be a thing I'm going to keep doing. So I don't know. The camera situation I might change. I mean, maybe I'll get like a cheap Sony to put in there that's not like a super high-end one or something, because it doesn't need to be for my purposes. I don't know. But somehow the camera thing might change. Otherwise, I'm otherwise very, very happy with this setup. The iPad video, I had a similar audio setup. People keep asking me about my audio because the iPad one sounds pretty good, actually. What I did for that was very similar. It's a boom mic. I went, so there's this wonderful YouTube channel called by a guy called Curtis Judd, with two D's on the end of Judd, and he does all sorts of tutorial videos and reviews of camera, lighting gear, and audio stuff for video. And I've been watching his videos for a while. I've learned a lot from them, and I went and bought his mic that he uses for this purpose, which is the Audio-Technica AT4053B. It's like $600, so this is not something I can recommend to everybody. It's a hypercardioid mic, not a shotgun, which he recommends for indoor dialogue, better than a shotgun, which for his reasoning and seeing his videos makes sense. It's a little bit better. I did still have to do post-processing with Isotope to reduce the reverb a little bit and to denoise a little bit, because it is still, you know, a good foot and a half from my mouth. But one of the good things about using the Canon as the camera instead of using my iPhone is that When I was shooting with the iPhone for the Mac Mini video, I very quickly learned that almost all the video I shot with the 2X lens was just too noisy to use. And if I apply a hell of a lot more light, maybe that can be different. But I was able to use almost none of it, because it was just the 2X lens has a narrower aperture and is smaller pixels, and so it's so much noisier than the video shot with a wide lens. So I ended up, I think the Mac Mini video, I think all of the iPhone video I have for that, I think it all was with the wide lens, or at least the vast majority of it. The sit down shot where I'm talking is also using the wide lens, as far as I remember. The problem is that if you have a boom mic that needs to be as close to your mouth as possible, so just barely out of frame, if you have a wide perspective, it has to be much further from your head than if you have a zoomed in perspective with a closer zoom lens. So the closer you're willing to zoom that lens in, the closer you can get the mic to you before it's in the frame. And so one of the reasons I switched to the Canon for the next video was this. And I'm not going to switch back to the iPhone because even the 45 millimeter, you know, ish lens on the iPhone, it's so noisy and it's so awkward to use that inside the teleprompter. I'm not a big fan of that. So I do want to stick with like a long perspective here, but somebody pointed out like that's one of the reasons the audio was so much better in the iPad video. Not only was it in sync properly because I recorded on the camera and synced to it, but also the microphone was able to be a lot closer to me and it was a better microphone. But honestly, the distance made a bigger difference than the microphone did.
In ATP tradition, I think John and I need to critique the videos, and I think I'd prefer to focus on the iPad video, and I thought it was really good, but you suffered, over the course of these two videos, you've suffered the same exact problems that I have, although you have also accelerated probably even quicker than I have in fixing them. In the first video, as you discussed, the audio was not great. In the second video, I think that the framing is great. I like the way it looks aesthetically. I think you had a lot of B-roll, which was good. I think you and I both need to talk less. But you have not yet solved the problem that I am getting better at solving, but have also not solved, which is being more effusive on camera and being more over the top. And I'm still not great at it by any stretch, but it's taken me, what, four videos to get to the point that I'm not... I don't think it's a problem for me anymore, but I definitely think I have room to grow. And hearing you talk about having a teleprompter and all that, I almost wonder if having the teleprompter, if it is more than bullets, and you had previously said it was just bullets for one of the videos. If it is more than bullets, I wonder if that's kind of letting you down. And if it is just bullets, then you just need to crank up the silly, or maybe not silly isn't the right word for it, but crank up the emotive, yeah, the humanity. Yeah, you weren't being a robot, but you were way more robotic than I know you to be, and that's because, again, having just been there, it's very awkward. Even in your own house, it's very awkward to be enthusiastic. I mean, look at me when I did my voiceover stuff for my first few, and actually even the most recent video, I think my voiceovers aren't quite as energetic as my other stuff because I am doing it in the house oftentimes at night, oftentimes when the kids are sleeping.
Your voiceover is like not trying to wake up your kid.
Exactly. Exactly.
Like, hey, I really love this car.
Yeah, right. You're exactly right. And so the problem is, even if you recognize it, which it sounds like you already did recognize it, it is a hard thing to fix. It just takes time. But that is the only thing that I was let down by. I mean, the audio stuff, whatever. It could be fixed, and you did fix it. But you need to, just like me, you need to be less of a robot, and it's something I'm working on, and I'm sure it's something that you're going to work on too.
And for clarification, and so like what was on the teleprompter? It was some bullet points, but it was also some like complete sentences that I wanted to say. Just like, you know, like so I'd remember like good wording that I wanted to say. One of the key differences between the two is that when I was doing the Mac Mini video, I did a lot more takes of that. Of my sit down, you know, basically whenever there's a B-roll shot in the Mac Mini video, chances are what you're coming back to after that is a different take. because that's like, you know, I use the B-roll to hide the transition. Because with the Mac Mini video, I had more of the sentences fully written out, and I had the teleprompter automatically just going at a fixed speed, and I couldn't adjust it during the shots. So I end up having to tweak a lot, like having to like, you know, add new lines between things, or you know, to like, you know, pad things out or slow things down so it would match the rate that I was actually and ended up saying it. You know, I adjusted the speed in the app because you can adjust the speed, but you know, it's still like a fixed speed if you're doing it that way. For the iPad video, for the second one, I took out of its box. I went in my closet, found the pile of things I bought 2 years ago, and took out of its box the Bluetooth foot page turner thing. Nice. it's like a rectangle you put on the floor. It looks kind of like a guitar effects pedal. You know, it's a box you put on the floor with two buttons on it, and you can map those two buttons to whatever you want them to do in the teleprompter app. for the iPad video, I was only using one of them, but I had it basically be play pause for the scrolling of the teleprompter. I could, at any point, I could just pause it if I needed more time on something and then unpause it. And that helped a lot with like being able to deliver things a little more smoothly. And, you know, it allowed me to riff more on certain things because I could just pause it and riff for a second and then unpause it. And it would resume instead of having to like try to like keep up with, oh, what am I gonna, I'm about to miss it. You know, I better keep going.
Yeah. Yeah. It, for me, I haven't yet really scripted any of my videos. That being said, tomorrow I'm going to attempt to record with actually two cars and basically drive 2 hours, record with two cars, and then drive home. And I basically have one day to get all this done. And so because of that, I've driven both of these cars a little bit in the past. And so I've put together an actual verbatim intro and conclusion, which I think was useful to get the flow of what I'm trying to say out of my head. But ultimately, I briefly looked into doing a teleprompter kind of thing. And what I think I'm just going to do is just read it right before I record it and just kind of wing it, which in past videos, I just kind of think about what I want to say. And I do like 15 takes. And eventually I find one that I think is pretty decent the whole way through. And occasionally, you know, like you said, once or twice I've swapped between takes in using B-roll. But generally speaking, if it's, you know, me outside of the car, especially in the intro and conclusion, I'll just do one shot, maybe 15 times, but I'll do one shot start to finish. And so I'm very interested to see how this goes tomorrow because I've put a lot more planning into this than any of the others I've ever done. But I don't know if that's going to be for the best or for the worst. So we shall see.
I would also say too, like, I don't think you would have much use for a teleprompter because I can't imagine it would work very well outdoors. And you tend to do all of your stand-ups outdoors. I can't see that being a thing. You need like somebody holding up giant cue cards and like flipping them.
Yeah, exactly. All right, John, what did you think?
You know, the same comments I always have on all these videos. More B-roll, less you. I don't need to see you. I need to see the iPads and the Mac Mini. That's you did have tons of B-roll as compared to your previous one, which is good. Big upgrade, especially on the Mac Mini or whatever. Like, but like when you're talking, I don't need to see you talking. Talk and show me the thing that you're telling me. And it was like, it had the moment that I always have in all these videos, all of Casey's and all of yours. The one that sticks out to me the most is when you were talking about how apps don't like fill the 12.9 inch iPad. Like they look awkward because the screen is so big, right? When you were describing that.
That was the one thing as I was editing. I'm like, you know, I really should have B-roll of this.
You really should. And don't tell me that and don't show me an app. Show me what you, it's a thing that we can't do on podcasts, right? You have to describe it with your mouth words, right? But on video, you could finally, I was like, finally, I'm going to get to see the awkward app layouts that he's talking about. Nope, didn't get to see him. Just got to look at you. I think you might have also missed focus on yourself when you're sitting in that chair. It seems to really like the high contrasty paper dog thing.
I think I was in focus, but I was in manual focus mode, and I had Tiff sit in the chair first, and I focused properly on her. I think
maybe you're leaning forward or back more, but your eyeballs look soft as compared to the nose of the fake dog.
Yeah, I mean, and that, like, it could have also been just like it could have either been lighting or it could have been a result of the you know rotation of the video that I had to do and everything. Who knows?
But, yeah, and the whole idea, both of you, that you have to have a single take stand up, like, forget about that. You don't need that. Like, you can have cutaways in your stand up. You can slice and dice your stand up into 12 pieces. Like, it does not need to be one continuous shot. Don't put this pressure on yourself to perform the soliloquy in a single take and doing it 15 times. Like, again, just watch some other people's videos. Like, yeah, we see them. We see their face. We know it's them. We get to know the face. But very briefly, and then it's off to whatever it is that we're talking about. And this person's still talking, like maybe they did the full stand-up when they were there. But once I get the idea of you're in a chair and you have a dog and you're talking about a thing, move on pretty quickly from that. I thought that most of the B-roll worked really well. Like for the most part, you were showing me relevant things that like what I wanted to see. I liked the action shots. Here you are using your iPad doing a thing in various environments, whether you're sitting on the couch or typing at it in the kitchen or whatever, where we don't have to hear the audio from that because you're just doing the voiceover. I like the part where the hop slicks your arm.
Yeah, that was not planned.
Well, you can't, you shouldn't be planned for it because the hop's licking you is not an infrequent occurrence. thought that was very cute. I do wonder if Hops is getting adequately compensated for his performance work. Is he part of the Screen Actors Guild? Hope you're at least paying him scale. He's a very important star of these shows. I noticed your little family dolls. I don't think I've seen them in real life. The little dolls of your family that you've got on the chair.
Mm-hmm. They've been on that chair for about 3 years.
That's cute. Yeah, I did notice also that you had to rearrange the room. Like, I didn't realize it was for the purposes of the video. I thought, oh, I guess they just rearranged their room at some point since last time I was there. But it makes sense now. So you rearrange it for the video. In terms of, you know, you're going to rearrange it for video. You sitting in a chair is fine and casual and looks nice. But I think there's a reason that most of the little set type things that technology YouTubers have involve some kind of a desk or flat surface where you can put down and talk about the things that you're messing with. And
yeah,
maybe even like Stephen Hackett have a camera up above the thing. So you can have sort of a, it doesn't all have to be B-roll. It can be, now switch to the overhead camera and you continue to talk about the thing that you're manipulating in your hand, but I get to see it from above. Anyway, those are all just vague thoughts, but in general, more B-roll. The audio sync thing, that was brutal. Like, I don't know what you can do about it. Like, the ship has sailed, but lesson learned. But it really makes it very difficult to watch the video because you're like, is something wrong with my computer? Is this video lagging? Is this some sort of problem with the HTML5 video player? It's like, no, it's just out of sync.
Yeah, and there were a number of good excuses for why some of the things you just mentioned are the way they are or were. You know, like with the Mac Mini thing, like I had a pretty firm deadline of like the Apple review embargo. I wanted to hit it because it's like, this is the first time they've given me review hardware. I wanted to really do it right. Of course, I'd had audio sync issues, but I'm like, I wanted to really make sure, like, I woke up at 6 a.m. to make sure I hit that embargo, like to hit publish and everything, like. And I really wanted to do it right. So I had that kind of hard deadline there. And then with the iPad one, we were going out of town for the weekend. And we were leaving, like, I hit publish on the video about 15 minutes before we left. And I drove for 2 hours. Like, so, like, I didn't see any of the feedback.
That is bold.
For, like, 2 hours afterwards. Because, like, we had a trip planned. We were going to Philly for the weekend. And we were like, oh, well, this is when we're going. And part of the reason why there wasn't B-roll showing how the apps are too wide on the 12.9 is because I had thought of that as I was editing. I'm like, I just don't have time. Like, I wish I would put this B-roll in, but like, I'm publishing this video in the next hour. Like, I just don't have time for that. And so part of it is like, yeah, I had this deadline. But also, like, looking back, I'm like, I'm glad I had. Oh, and also, like, yes, I could have waited and published it, like, you know, maybe yesterday. But like, I wanted to get this video out while it was still iPad launch week. I wanted to be reasonably current. I thought it ended up being kind of a good thing that I only had a very small amount of time to do it in, because ultimately, like, I probably would have even done a whole different set of takes for the main stand-up, because like, there were things in the main stand-up, like I'm holding the 12.9 iPad upside down, which is very obvious, like, when you watch it. And like, there's stuff like that. Like, if I had more time, I would have reshot that whole thing just to fix stuff like that. But I didn't. And so I'm like, well, I got to just use what I got and just go with it. And there's some value to having that kind of pressure, because otherwise, like, I would be closer to a perfectionist and just try to reshoot everything, do everything exactly perfectly. And it would take way too long. And then I would say, I'm never doing a video again. You know, like, and then put all this stuff back in the closet for 2 years. So, like, it's actually kind of nice to have those deadlines and to have something firmly come by and say, whatever you have now, you just got to ship it. So that was very nice. And then I do agree with you that I don't have the ideal furniture for this. The way we created this video set was basically rearranging the furniture we already had. But long term, I do agree with you that like some kind of desk or table in front of me, and maybe I could be at standing height, would be probably better. That's a much bigger operation than just moving the stuff in the room around. So that's probably further in the future.
Time constraints are good, but if you have to funnel your perfectionism into something, I wouldn't do it on like, you know, more takes and more perfecting the shots that you have. I would concentrate the perfectionism on kind of like the Pixar brain trust type thing, where they spend tons and tons of time when things are in storyboard, where it's just a bunch of like sketches up on pieces of paper up on a big board, because that's like spending all your time there rearranging that. And then even if your execution, once you finally come out with the way it's going to be done, once you have all the shots laid out, then if your execution is not great because you don't have a lot of time, fine. It's much better to invest the time into getting the correct flow of shots and script and then executing in a mediocre whatever way that you get better at than perfectly executing a series of shots that don't flow the way, you know what I mean? Like the more important, the harder thing to get right is the general script and structure of shots.
Yeah.
Less the execution of them. Because it, you know, especially like we don't care how beautifully framed and how nice we can see you sitting on the chairs are. And we do want to see the products, but you're going to see them enough. If you do your job well, even the noisy video, like it may bother you that it's noisy, but like just getting the shot sequence and the script right is so much more important than the individual shots. So that I would, if you do end up having time, more time, the next time you do a video, that's where I would invest it. Because honestly, the audio and video quality is plenty good enough for YouTube already. You're not going to, you're going to get most of the value of making the video better, of figuring out that the chunkier stuff than the details of execution.
Oh, sure. And you know, like the script writing takes way more time than the actual video. You know, like figuring out what to say and how to say it is like that took the vast majority of the time that you know, of like the overall production of this of these videos.
I wonder if other technology channels even write scripts. It seems to me that a lot of them are just winging it. You just kind of get used to it and you just kind of like go in there and you say a bunch of stuff and then you sort of make the video in the edit, right? Because again, if you're not on camera, if you're not on camera and not expected to do a continuous take stand up and you're just seeing someone's hands anyway, just talk about the thing that you've got. Say all the stuff you want to say about it. If there's a particular turn of phrase you want to say, have that on a note card somewhere you can look at. But in general, like when I watch these technology videos, I'm thinking nobody scripted this. They just sat down in front of the camera and they talked about it for a while. And then they cut it together and cut out the boring parts and spliced it together and maybe did one additional audio recording of a thing they forgot to say. And that's it. They were done. Like it's a high bar. I mean, I think it's more important, unfortunately, for Casey to script it because it's like car reviews are more of a structured thing and you can't really like ramble while you're driving because this, you know, I think it's harder for car reviews, but for technology reviews, I think you could just, I mean, you've said all the same things about the stuff. You can just get up there and talk about it. And then just, you know, make sure that we're looking at B-roll or your hands manipulating a device and not your face and your mouth moving. And you can turn that into exactly what you wanted to say in post.
Yeah, that's fair. I do intend to get less scripted as I go. Like these I scripted simply because I was brand new at it and I didn't like, I wanted to hit certain points and I wanted to be careful on how I worded them. And I also didn't want to miss, I didn't want to like forget something I wanted to say, you know, like I would come up with impressions or comments as I was using these devices and I'd write them down in a big Apple Notes file. And then like, eventually I'm like, all right, now I need to like compose a video. So I arrange them and, you know, make an outline, you know, make some actual like, you know, bullet points and some actual lines I wanted to say and everything. And I didn't want to miss anything. Like, I didn't want to forget to say anything, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. But in my experience, what ends up happening is there are two or three things like in an intro or a conclusion that I really, really want to say because I think they're clever, they're funny or what have you. And then everything else is a lot more malleable than I think it is. And as long as I nail the two or three things that I'm really, really entranced with, whatever they may be, everything else just kind of works itself out.
It's funny, like the part that where I threw the old pencil on the ground, that was like that wasn't in my script or outline. I'm just like, I had nowhere to put it. And so I'm like, I got to get rid of this real fast. And so I just kind of like came up with that. And people love that. Like that was like a favorite moment for a lot of people in the video. So, yeah, I guess I'll start, you know, scripting less.
Let me discourage you and Stephen Hackett. Please stop throwing things on video. You're going to break something. It's very upsetting. He's always throwing stuff in his video. Now you're doing it.
It was a very soft carpet.
Don't throw your hardware. Yeah, yours was less egregious than his. He threw like the $300 Apple book. I remember that. That was just, he's throwing his iPads. He's thrown everything. He's thrown devices on top of each other into the frame of the camera. It's like, stop throwing your hardware. It's expensive. It's fragile.
Yeah, I think ultimately my furniture setup should probably become some kind of table thing. Kind of like what I like what Chase Reeves does, our wonderful friend Chase Reeves. He does wonderful backpack reviews and stuff on his YouTube channel. And actually, I do want to, I mentioned last week I've been on kind of a backpack odyssey, and I do want to do a couple of videos on my backpack stuff. And it's going to be very hard, you know, similar to like how it's hard for Casey to not just try to be Doug DeMuro. It's going to be very hard for me to not try to be Chase Reeves, because I'm not Chase Reeves and I could never be. But I do want to do stuff like that also. Like, it isn't just going to be like, here's the newest Apple thing. Like, I'm not going to do a video on the MacBook Air because I don't have one. Apple didn't give me one, and I'm not going to go buy one just for that. So I'm probably not going to do that. But I do want to do other things like, you know, backpack stuff and travel stuff and maybe coffee stuff and other kinds of stuff. I don't know.
You did a DeMuro intro, you realized, on your iPad Pro review.
I've never seen a DeMuro video, so I have no idea what you're talking about.
Every one of his videos starts like this. Ready? This is the new iPad Pro. This is the whatever. It's that they all so start true. With that. Every single one. So that's true. I mean, that's his shtick. He's got a format, and that's the format. But you unknowingly exactly match the format.
Damn it.
So now you don't need to watch a Doug DeMuro video. You can just watch my four videos over and over and over again.
You don't do any DeMuro intros, do you?
I mean, not knowingly. I don't try to.
This is the 2019 Audi A4.
No, certainly not knowingly.
This is a backpack. I don't know. I don't know any backpacks. I can't insert a name.
Yeah, well, just think of me and wish me luck tomorrow as I try to cover two cars in the span of like 6 hours. Well, I usually have a week.
DeMuro could do three cars in that amount of time.
He could. I'm not Doug DeMuro.
Well, but again, like, that will probably help you the same way my deadlines helped me.
Just don't crash the car, please.
Well, the problem I have with it is that I think it will help me in the broad, like at a macro level, but I'm really scared that I will take all this time and take some time from a friend of mine to do this and then have nothing good to show for it on the other end. You know, like, I'll learn a lot about how to make these things quicker, but I'm scared I won't have enough to make one good video out of, which is all I'm intending for this one video to be both cars. I'm not intending to get two videos worth of stuff out of this, but I'm scared that I'm going to spend, you know, like 6 or 8 hours, you know, doing all this and then have nothing to show for it when it's Final Cut Pro time. So we'll see.
So make a crappy one.
You can always fall back to, I mean, I don't know how much you've done this in your other videos, but this seems to me the easier route is you got a bunch of footage and maybe you've got a bunch of audio with it and maybe it doesn't come out that well, but it has the moments that you wanted in it, that you narrate over footage that already has its own audio. So basically you have the video and then you have your commenting on the video and that is the final video. Because if you just present the video as is, like it's too, like it's not good because the shot is blurry or the camera is shaky or the audio is bad.
So the regular car reviews approach of doing things.
Yeah, but then in the video, you can, in front of your podcast microphone, record a voiceover that explains what's going on in the video that you couldn't explain in the moment, but you caught some funny moment or you showed something or you're explaining what is not very apparent on the video and the fact that it's revealing about the cars or whatever. So you can always do that.
Yeah, and that is something I'm not above doing. It's just a matter of, you know, what can I do with potentially a second shooter, which is both good and bad, because that makes me even more self-conscious about all the stupid things I'm saying. But, you know, what can I do with a second shooter and a lot more of a plan than I've ever had before, but still kind of shooting from the hip. So we shall see.
I will say, dealing with the YouTube back end, it is as bad as everyone says. One of the things, so like I decided, you know, I wanted to make sure, now that I'm taking this more seriously, I wanted to make sure that youtube.com/MarcoArment or, you know, like whatever the custom URL scheme, I wanted to make sure I had that. I know that like it's not automatic, or at least maybe not always automatic. So I wanted to make sure, like, I want that. I want to get my URL set up. Trying to do that, trying to figure out how to do that even, is its own little adventure. Then once I found out how, it's like, I can't just be /MarcoArment. I have to be like /MarcoArment and then add some characters afterwards. It wouldn't let me just take my name. And in certain ways, my name already works. Like it's certain URL formulations, it already works. But not all, like this, you know, /channel, whatever ones. And it's like, oh, you can add this. You know, you just register for this here, but you have to only have the thing after your name. I'm like, okay. So I tried searching everywhere to figure out why is it making me add characters to get my name that is not taken in these other places. And it turns out, oh, well, that's because to get just your name, you have to be part of the partner program, which is their euphemism for you have ads in your channel. And that, of course, is documented nowhere. It's like, you know, you end up searching and you find like a Usenet posting or something. And so eventually I learn I have to be a partner. So I go in, all right, how do I become a partner? So I went and signed up, and it's, oh, I have to sign up for an AdSense account. Great. So I can't have a good URL unless I put ads on my channel. Because like, I'm not going to make money from this in any meaningful way for a long time, if ever. So like, I'm just like, I'd rather not even have the ads probably, you know, but I can't be like a class A YouTuber in the features set unless I turn on ads basically. And so I'm like, all right, fine, I'll turn on ads. So I applied to the AdSense account. I get an email a day later saying, you already have an AdSense account, limit one per person. And the one I had is the old one for like, there was like a 6 month period where Overcast ran Google AdMob ads, like in the app, like little banners. You know, I haven't actually run those ads in the current version of the app for over a year. And I you know, but there was like, you know, $18 in unpaid funds sitting in it, you know? And so I'm like, all right, how do I close that? Because that's, I don't want to reuse that account. That's for Overcast. It's a whole different business. It's a different, you know, LLC. Like I want a separate one for just me as, you know, as the YouTuber. So, okay, how do I do that? I challenge you to try to find how to close an AdSense account.
Oh, that's no surprise.
There is a help page on YouTube. It says, you know, because in the email that you get that says you have a duplicate account, there's a link to Google help documents that say how to close it. And you can follow every one of those instructions. And the things that it says are there aren't there. So it's like, okay, it says to go here to this page and then click the button, but the button it says will be there isn't there. What now? Where is it? Eventually, I think I found like a Quora post that linked directly to some like customer service form on Google's site that you could fill out to request cancellation of your account, which is linked to seemingly nowhere else. I did eventually fill that out like after verifying, like, is this even real? Like, am I getting fished? Like, what is going on here? But it was real. I filled it out. I got an email like, you know, a day later saying, okay, we've canceled your old account. We'll be sending you $18 somehow. And then I finally could get my partner program approved to the point where it's now in review. So, sometime in the last, it says they will decide, quote, usually within a month or so. So sometime in the next month or so, I will be approved, I hope, for monetization that I don't want, so I can just get the URL I want.
It is a total disaster.
This is a great time to remind everybody that they should go to youtube.com/Syracuse. The spelling is in the theme song for this podcast, and you will find my beautiful correct URL for my YouTube channel that I got a long time ago, even though I don't make videos, because the most important thing you can do with every service is reserve a good URL for yourself. So let this be a lesson to you, Marco. Always reserve a cool URL for yourself, even when you have no plans to make videos.
Thanks.
And I put up a new video since we last recorded, too, by the way.
Oh,
there's,
yeah?
No audio sync issues to speak of. It's not in 4K because my PS4 only records at 1080p, so sorry about that.
Snipes Awakening.
Doesn't feature any pictures of me or anything in my house or any products. It's just all Destiny all the time.
Yay.
So I'm a little curious, John, like why, so what are these Destiny videos of? Are these like, you know, special events, special achievements you've gotten? And I'm curious, like, you know, both.
I can't believe you haven't watched my videos. Why do you have this question? You should just go to my channel and watch all my videos.
I'm watching this now and I don't know what's going on.
Your view count will be significant.
Yeah, right.
Your single view will be a significant contribution. It'll be lost in the noise in a popular channel, but in my channel, I'll see your view. I'll be like, oh, look, Marco watched it. The number went up by one.
So I am curious, like, you know, why? Because, you know, you're not much of a public sharer in most forms. Why are you posting these videos?
I'm engaged in the Destiny community. They're all Destiny videos. I like Destiny. And so this is a part of the genius of the PS4, as as many people have noted in the years since the PS4 has come out, when they introduced the PS4 and it showed that one of the buttons on the controller, the precious controller real estate, had been dedicated to a button simply had the word share under it. Like, the share button, of all the things you're going to put on the controller, a button called share. How dumb is that? What, you will come to regret this, that you wasted a button on the controller face for share. Who the heck is going to do that? The answer is, when you make it, when you put that button on the controller and you make it really easy to share anything cool that has happened.
Ooh, crossfades.
On your console, people use it all the time. And so if I do anything fun or cool or interesting,
supercharged
on my PS4, I hit the share button and it saves the last like configurable amount of video, like so the last 15 minutes or whatever that I've done. And then every once in a while, I pull that video off and I cut together into some kind of sequence and I throw it up on YouTube. It's just a way to share cool things that have happened to me or that I've done or that are interesting to me in Destiny. And there's no way I would do it if it was like there was some kind of burden where I had to like get some sort of recording equipment and premeditate and think I'm gonna record some stuff or whatever. This is just like I play my PlayStation all the time. I play Destiny a ton. And if something interesting happens, I hit the share button and I save a video. And then every few months, I have all this footage and I can put it together and make something out of it.
So everyone, if you like Destiny, go to youtube.com/Syracusa.
I have no idea what I just watched. It just looked like footage of you playing a video game.
You got it. That's what it is. Yeah, it's not quite as broadly interesting as stuff about Apple hardware.